Chapter 6. The Story of the Inexperienced Ghost. The scene amidst which Clayton told his last story comes back very vividly to my mind. There he sat, for the greater part of the time, in the corner of the authentic settle by the spacious open fire, and Sanderson sat beside him smoking the Broseley clay that bore his name. There was Evans, and that marvel among actors, Wish, who is also a modest man. We had all come down to the Mermaid Club that Saturday morning, except Clayton, who had slept there overnight, which indeed gave him the opening of his story. We had gulfed until gulfing was invisible. We had dined, and we were in that mood of tranquil kindliness, when men will suffer a story. When Clayton began to tell one, we naturally supposed he was lying. It may be that indeed he was lying of, that the reader will speedily be able to judge as well as I. He began, it is true, with an air of matter-of-fact anecdote, but that we thought was only the incurable artifice of the man. I say, he remarked, after a long consideration of the upward rain of sparks from the log that Sanderson had thumped, you know I was alone here last night? Except for the domestics, said Wish. Who sleep in the other wing, said Clayton. Why, yes. Well, he pulled at his cigar for some little time, as though he still hesitated about his confidence. Then he said, quite quietly, I caught a ghost. Caught a ghost, did you? Said Sanderson. Where is it? And Evans, who admires Clayton immensely, and has been 4 weeks in America, shouted, caught a ghost, did you, Clayton? I'm glad of it. Tell us all about it right now. Clayton said he would in a minute, and asked him to shut the door. He looked apologetically at me. There's no eavesdropping, of course, but we don't want to upset our very excellent service with any rumors of ghosts in the place. There's too much shadow and oak paneling to trifle with that. And this, you know, wasn't a regular ghost. I don't think it will come again, ever. You mean to say you didn't keep it? Said Sanderson. I hadn't the heart to, said Clayton. And Sanderson said he was surprised. We laughed, and Clayton looked aggrieved. I know, he said, with the flicker of a smile, but the fact is it really was a ghost, and I'm as sure of it as I am that I am talking to you now. I'm not joking. I mean what I say. Sanderson drew deeply at his pipe, with one reddish eye on Clayton, and then emitted a thin jet of smoke more eloquent than many words. Clayton ignored the comment. It is the strangest thing that has ever happened in my life. You know, I never believed in ghosts or anything of the sort, before, ever, and then, you know, I bag one in a corner, and the whole business is in my hands. He meditated still more profoundly, and produced and began to pierce a second cigar with a curious little stabber he affected. You talked to it? Asked Wish. For the space, probably, of an hour. Chatty? I said, joining the party of the skeptics. The poor devil was in trouble, said Clayton, bowed over his cigar end, and with the very faintest note of reproof. Sobbing? Someone asked. Clayton heaved a realistic sigh at the memory. Gee, good Lord. He said, yes. And then, poor fellow. Yes. Where did you strike it? Asked Evans, in his best American accent. I never realized, said Clayton, ignoring him, the poor sort of thing a ghost might be, and he hung us up again for a time, while he sought four matches in his pocket, and lit and warmed to his cigar. I took an advantage, he reflected at last. We were none of us in a hurry. A character, he said, remains just the same character for all that it's been disembodied. That's a thing we too often forget. People with a certain strength or fixity of purpose may have ghosts of a certain strength and fixity of purpose. Most haunting ghosts, you know, must be as one-ideated as monomaniacs, and as obstinate as mules to come back again and again. This poor creature wasn't. He suddenly looked up rather queerly, and his eye went round the room. I say it, he said, in all kindliness, but that is the plain truth of the case. Even at the first glance he struck me as weak. he punctuated with the help of his cigar. I came upon him, you know, in the long passage. His back was towards me, and I saw him first. Right off I knew him for a ghost. He was transparent and whitish. Clean through his chest I could see the glimmer of the little window at the end. And not only his physique, but his attitude struck me as being weak. He looked, you know, as though he didn't know in the slightest whatever he meant to do. One hand was on the paneling, and the other fluttered to his mouth. Like so. What sort of physique? Said Sanderson. Lean. You know that sort of young man's neck, that has two great flutings down the back, here and here so. And a little, meanish head with scrubby hair and rather bad ears. Shoulders bad, narrower than the hips. Turned down collar, ready-made short jacket. Trousers baggy and a little frayed at the heels. That's how he took me. I came very quietly up the staircase. I did not carry a light, you know the candles are on the landing table and there is that lamp, and I was in my list slippers, and I saw him as I came up. I stopped dead at that, taking him in. I wasn't a bit afraid. I think that in most of these affairs one is never nearly so afraid, or excited as one imagines one would be. I was surprised and interested. I thought, good Lord, here's a ghost at last. And I haven't believed for a moment in ghosts during the last 25 years. Said Wish. I suppose I wasn't on the landing a moment before he found out I was there. He turned on me sharply, and I saw the face of an immature young man, a weak nose, a scrubby little mustache, a feeble chin. So for an instant we stood, he looking over his shoulder at me, and regarded one another. Then he seemed to remember his high calling. He turned round, drew himself up, projected his face, raised his arms, spread his hands in approved ghost fashion, came towards me. As he did, so his little jaw dropped, and he emitted a faint, drawn-out boo. No, it wasn't, not a bit dreadful. I dined. I'd had a bottle of champagne, and being all alone, perhaps 2 or 3, perhaps even 4 or 5 whiskies, so I was as solid as rocks, and no more frightened than if I'd been assailed by a frog. Boo! I said. Nonsense! You don't belong to this place. What are you doing here? I could see him wince. Boo-oo, he said. Boo be hanged. Are you a member? I said. And just to show I didn't care a pin for him, I stepped through a corner of him, and made to light my candle. Are you a member? I repeated, looking at him sideways. He moved a little so, as to stand clear of me, and his bearing became crestfallen. No, he said, in answer to the persistent interrogation of my eye. I'm not a member, I'm a ghost. Well, that doesn't give you the run of the Mermaid Club. Is there anyone you want to see, or anything of that sort? And doing it as steadily as possible for fear that he should mistake the carelessness of whiskey for the distraction of fear, I got my candle alight. I turned on him, holding it. What are you doing here? I said. He had dropped his hands, and stopped his booing, and there he stood, abashed and awkward, the ghost of a weak, silly, aimless young man. I'm haunting, he said. You haven't any business to, I said in a quiet voice. I'm a ghost, he said, as if in defense. That may be, but you haven't any business to haunt here. This is a respectable private club. People often stop here with nursemaids and children, and, going about in the careless way you do, some poor little mite could easily come upon you, and be scared out of her wits. I suppose you didn't think of that? No, sir, he said, I didn't. You should have done. You haven't any claim on the place, have you? Weren't murdered here, or anything of that sort. None, sir, but I thought as it was old, and oak-paneled, that's no excuse. I regarded him firmly. "You're coming here is a mistake," apostrophe I said, in a tone of friendly superiority. I feigned to see if I had my matches, and then looked up at him frankly. "If I were you, I wouldn't wait for cockcrow, I'd vanish right away." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he looked embarrassed. "The fact is, sir, apostrophe," he began. "I'd vanish, apostrophe," I said, driving it home. "The fact is, sir, that somehow I can't." Apostrophe, apostrophe, you can't? Apostrophe, apostrophe, no, sir. There's something I've forgotten. I've been hanging about here since midnight last night, hiding in the cupboards of the empty bedrooms and things like that. I'm flurried. I've never come haunting before, and it seems to put me out. Apostrophe, apostrophe, put you out? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, sir. I've tried to do it several times, and it doesn't come off. There's some little thing that slipped me, and I can't get back. Apostrophe, apostrophe, that, you know, rather bowled me over. He looked at me in such an abject way, that for the life of me, I couldn't keep up quite the high, hectoring vein I had adopted. "That's queer, apostrophe," I said, and as I spoke I fancied I heard someone moving about down below. "Come into my room, and tell me more about it, apostrophe," I said. I didn't, of course, understand this, apostrophe, and I tried to take him by the arm. But, of course, you might as well have tried to take hold of a puff of smoke. I had forgotten my number, I think. Anyhow, I remember going into several bedrooms. It was lucky I was the only soul in that wing until I saw my traps. "Here we are, apostrophe," I said, and sat down in the armchair. "Sit down and tell me all about it. It seems to me, you have got yourself into a jolly awkward position, old chap." Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, he said he wouldn't sit down. He'd prefer to flit up and down the room, if it was all the same to me. And so he did, and in a little while we were deep in a long and serious talk. And presently, you know, something of those whiskies and sodas evaporated out of me, and I began to realize just a little what a thundering rum and weird business it was that I was in. There he was, semi-transparent, the proper conventional phantom, and noiseless except for his ghost of a voice flitting to and fro in that nice, clean, chintz-hung old bedroom. You could see the gleam of the copper candlesticks through him, and the lights on the brass fender, and the corners of the framed engravings on the wall, and there he was telling me all about this wretched little life of his that had recently ended on Earth. He hadn't a particularly honest face, you know, but being transparent, of course, he couldn't avoid telling the truth. "Eh?" said Wish, suddenly sitting up in his chair. "What?" said Clayton. "Being transparent couldn't avoid telling the truth, I don't see it," said Wish. "I don't see it," said Clayton, with inimitable assurance. "Be but it is so, I can assure you nevertheless. I don't believe he got once a nail's breadth off the Bible truth. He told me how he had been killed. He went down into a London basement with a candle, to look for a leakage of gas, and described himself as a senior English master in a London private school when that release occurred." "Poor wretch," said I, "that's what I thought," and the more he talked the more I thought it. There he was, purposeless in life and purposeless out of it. He talked of his father and mother and his schoolmaster, and all who had ever been anything to him in the world, meanly. He had been too sensitive, too nervous. None of them had ever valued him properly or understood him, he said. He had never had a real friend in the world, I think. He had never had a success. He had shirked games and failed examinations. "It's like that with some people," apostrophe, he said. "Whenever I got into the examination room, or anywhere, everything seemed to go. Apostrophe, apostrophe, engaged to be married, of course, to another oversensitive person, I suppose, when the indiscretion with the gas escape ended his affairs." "And where are you now?" apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. "Not in," apostrophe, he wasn't clear on that point at all. The impression he gave me was of a sort of vague, intermediate state, a special reserve for souls too non-existent for anything so positive as either sin or virtue. I don't know. He was much too egotistical and unobservant to give me any clear idea of the kind of place, kind of country, there is on the other side of things. Wherever he was, he seems to have fallen in with a set of kindred spirits. Ghosts of weak Cockney young men, who were on a footing of Christian names, and among these there was certainly a lot of talk about going haunting and things like that. Yes, going haunting. They seemed to think haunting a tremendous adventure, and most of them funked it all the time. And so primed, you know, he had come. But really, said Wish to the fire. These are the impressions he gave me, anyhow, said Clayton, modestly. I may, of course, have been in a rather uncritical state, but that was the sort of background he gave to himself. He kept flitting up and down, with his thin voice going talking about his wretched self, and never a word of clear, firm statement from first to last. He was thinner and sillier, and more pointless, than if he had been real and alive. Only then, you know, he would not have been in my bedroom here if he had been alive. I should have kicked him out. Of course, said Evans, there are poor mortals like that. And there's just as much chance of their having ghosts as the rest of us, I admitted. What gave a sort of point to him, you know, was the fact that he did seem within limits to have found himself out. The mess he had made of haunting had depressed him terribly. He had been told it would be a lark. He had come expecting it to be a lark, apostrophe, and here it was, nothing but another failure added to his record. He proclaimed himself an utter out-and-out failure. He said, and I can quite believe it, that he had never tried to do anything all his life, that he hadn't made a perfect mess of, and through all the wastes of eternity he never would. If he had had sympathy, perhaps he paused at that, and stood regarding me. He remarked that, strange as it might seem to me, nobody, not anyone, ever, had given him the amount of sympathy I was doing now. I could see what he wanted straight away, and I determined to head him off at once. I may be a brute, you know, but being the only real friend, the recipient of the confidences of one of these egotistical weaklings, ghost, or body, is beyond my physical endurance. I got up briskly. Don't you brood on these things too much, apostrophe, I said. The thing you've got to do is to get out of this sharp. You pull yourself together and try. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I can't, apostrophe, he said. You try, I said, and try he did. Try, said Sanderson. How? Passes, said Clayton. Passes? Complicated series of gestures and passes with the hands. That's how he had come in, and that's how he had to get out again. Lord! What a business I had! But how could any series of passes, I began. My dear man, said Clayton, turning on me, and putting a great emphasis on certain words, you want everything clear. I don't know how. All I know, is that you do that he did, anyhow, at least. After a fearful time, you know, he got his passes right and suddenly disappeared. Did you, said Sanderson, slowly observe the passes? Yes, said Clayton, and seemed to think. It was tremendously queer, he said. See, there we were, I and this thin vague ghost, in that silent room, in this silent, empty inn, in this silent little Friday night town. Not a sound except our voices, and a faint panting he made when he swung. There was the bedroom candle, and one candle on the dressing table alight, that was all sometimes one, or other would flare up into a tall, lean, astonished flame for a space. And queer things happened. I can't, apostrophe he said. I shall never, apostrophe, and suddenly he sat down on the little chair at the foot of the bed, and began to sob and sob. Lord! What a harrowing, whimpering thing he seemed. You pull yourself together, apostrophe I said, and tried to pat him on the back, and... my confounded hand went through him. By that time, you know, I wasn't nearly so massive as I had been on the landing. I got the queerness of it full. I remember snatching back my hand out of him, as it were, with a little thrill, and walking over to the dressing table. You pull yourself together, apostrophe I said to him, and try. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and in order to encourage and help him, I began to try as well. What? Said Sanderson, the passes? Yes, the passes. But I said, moved by an idea that eluded me for a space. This is interesting, said Sanderson, with his finger in his pipe bowl. Why, you mean to say this ghost of yours gave away, did his level best to give away the whole confounded barrier? Yes. He didn't, said Wish. He couldn't. Or you'd have gone there too. That's precisely it, I said, finding my elusive idea put into words for me. That is precisely it, said Clayton, with thoughtful eyes upon the fire. For just a little while there was silence. And at last he did it? Said Sanderson. At last he did it. I had to keep him up to it hard, but he did it at last rather suddenly. He despaired, we had a scene, and then he got up abruptly, and asked me to go through the whole performance, slowly, so that he might see. I believe, apostrophe he said, if I could see I should spot what was wrong at once. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and he did. Apostrophe I know, apostrophe he said. What do you know? Apostrophe said I apostrophe I know, he repeated. Then he said, peevishly, I can't do it, if you look at me I really can't, it's been that, partly, all along. I'm such a nervous fellow, that you put me out. Apostrophe apostrophe well, we had a bit of an argument. Naturally I wanted to see, but he was as obstinate as a mule, and suddenly I had come over as tired as a dog, he tired me out. All right, apostrophe I said, apostrophe I won't look at you, apostrophe and turned towards the mirror, on the wardrobe, by the bed. He started off very fast. I tried to follow him, by looking in the looking glass, to see just what it was that hung. Round went his arms and his hands, so, and so, and so, and then with a rush, came to the last gesture of all, you stand erect and open out your arms, and so, don't you know, he stood. And then he didn't. He didn't. He wasn't. I wheeled round from the looking glass to him. There was nothing, I was alone, with the flaring candles and a staggering mind. What had happened? Had anything happened? Had I been dreaming? And then, with an absurd note of finality about it, the clock upon the landing discovered the moment was ripe for striking one. So, ping! And I was as grave and sober as a judge, with all my champagne and whiskey gone into the vast serene. Feeling queer, you know, confoundedly queer. Queer. Good Lord. He regarded his cigar ash for a moment. Tea, that's all that happened, he said. And then you went to bed? Asked Evans. What else was there to do? I looked Wish in the eye. We wanted to scoff, and there was something, something perhaps in Clayton's voice and manner, that hampered our desire. And about these passes? Said Sanderson. I believe I could do them now. Oh, said Sanderson, and produced a penknife, and set himself to grub the dottle out of the bowl of his clay. Why don't you do them now? Said Sanderson, shutting his penknife with a click. That's what I'm going to do, said Clayton. They won't work, said Evans. If they do, I suggested. You know, I'd rather you didn't, said Wish, stretching out his legs. Why? Asked Evans. I'd rather he didn't, said Wish. But he hasn't got 'em right, said Sanderson, plugging too much tobacco in his pipe. All the same, I'd rather he didn't, said Wish. We argued with Wish. He said that for Clayton, to go through those gestures was like mocking a serious matter. But you don't believe, I said. Wish glanced at Clayton, who was staring into the fire, weighing something in his mind. I do more than half, anyhow, I do, said Wish. Clayton, said I, you're too good a liar for us. Most of it was all right. But that disappearance. Dot happened to be convincing. Tell us, it's a tale of cock and bull. He stood up without heeding me, took the middle of the earthrig, and faced me. For a moment he regarded his feet thoughtfully, and then for all the rest of the time his eyes were on the opposite wall, with an intent expression. He raised his two hands slowly to the level of his eyes and so began. Now, Sanderson is a Freemason, a member of the Lodge of the Four Kings, which devotes itself so ably to the study and elucidation of all the mysteries of Masonry past and present, and among the students of this Lodge Sanderson is by no means the least. He followed Clayton's motions with a singular interest in his reddish eye. "Tee, that's not bad," he said, when it was done. "Why, you really do, you know, put things together, Clayton, in a most amazing fashion. But there's one little detail out." "I know," said Clayton. I believe I could tell you which." "Well?" "This," said Clayton, and did a queer little twist and writhing and thrust of the hands. "Yes. That, you know, was what he couldn't get right," said Clayton. "But how do you, most of this business, and particularly how you invented it, I don't understand at all," said Sanderson, "but just that phase I do." He reflected. "These happen to be a series of gestures connected with a certain branch of esoteric masonry. Probably you know. Or else how?" He reflected still further. "I do not see I can do any harm in telling you just the proper twist. After all, if you know, you know. If you don't, you don't." "I know nothing," said Clayton, "except what the poor devil let out last night." "Well, anyhow," said Sanderson, and placed his churchwarden very carefully upon the shelf over the fireplace. Then very rapidly he gesticulated with his hands. "So?" said Clayton, repeating. "So," said Sanderson, and took his pipe in hand again. "Ah, now," said Clayton, "I can do the whole thing right." He stood up before the waning fire and smiled at us all. But I think there was just a little hesitation in his smile. If I begin," he said. "I wouldn't begin," said Wish. "It's all right," said Evans. "Matter is indestructible. You don't think any jiggery-pokery of this sort is going to snatch Clayton into the world of shades? Not it. You may try, Clayton, so far as I'm concerned, until your arms drop off at the wrists." "I don't believe that," said Wish, and stood up and put his arm on Clayton's shoulder. "Why, you've made me half believe in that story somehow, and I don't want to see the thing done." "Goodness," said I, "here's Wish frightened." "I am," said Wish, with real or admirably feigned intensity. I believe that, if he goes through these motions right, he'll go." "He'll not do anything of the sort," I cried. "There's only one way out of this world for men, and Clayton is 30 years from that. Besides, and such a ghost. Do you think?" Wish interrupted me by moving. He walked out from among our chairs, and stopped beside the toll and stood there. "See, Clayton," he said, "you're a fool." Clayton, with a humorous light in his eyes, smiled back at him. "Wish," he said, "is right and all you others are wrong. I shall go. I shall get to the end of these passes, and as the last swish whistles through the air, presto, this earthrig will be vacant, the room will be blank amazement, and a respectably dressed gentleman of 15 stone will plump into the world of shades. I'm certain. So will you be. I decline to argue further. Let the thing be tried." "No," said Wish, and made a step and ceased, and Clayton raised his hands once more to repeat the spirit's passing. By that time, you know, we were all in a state of tension largely because of the behavior of Wish. We sat all of us with our eyes on Clayton, I, at least, with a sort of tight, stiff feeling about me, as though from the back of my skull to the middle of my thighs my body had been changed to steel. And there, with a gravity that was imperturbably serene, Clayton bowed and swayed and waved his hands and arms before us. As he drew towards the end, one piled up, one tingled in one's teeth. The last gesture, I have said, was to swing the arms out wide open, with the face held up. and when at last he swung out to his closing gesture I ceased even to breathe. It was ridiculous, of course, but you know that ghost story feeling. It was after dinner, in a queer, old shadowy house. Woody, after all, there he stood for one stupendous moment, with his arms open and his upturned face, assured and bright, in the glare of the hanging lamp. We hung through that moment, as if it were an age, and then came from all of us something that was half a sigh of infinite relief and half a reassuring oh. For visibly he wasn't going. It was all nonsense. He had told an idle story, and carried it almost to conviction, that was all. ... And then in that moment the face of Clayton changed. It changed. It changed as a lit house changes, when its lights are suddenly extinguished. His eyes were suddenly eyes that were fixed, his smile was frozen on his lips, and he stood there still. He stood there, very gently swaying. That moment, too, was an age. And then, you know, chairs were scraping, things were falling, and we were all moving. His knees seemed to give, and he fell forward, and Evans rose, and caught him in his arms. ... It stunned us all. For a minute I suppose no one said a coherent thing. We believed it, yet could not believe it. ... I came out of a muddled stupefaction, to find myself kneeling beside him, and his vest and shirt were torn open, and Sanderson's hand lay on his heart. ... Well, the simple fact before us could very well wait our convenience. There was no hurry for us to comprehend. It lay there for an hour. It lies athwart my memory, black and amazing still, to this day. Clayton had, indeed, passed into the world that lies so near to, and so far from our own, and he had gone thither by the only road that mortal man may take. But whether he did indeed pass there by that poor ghost's incantation, or whether he was stricken suddenly by apoplexy in the midst of an idle tale as the coroner's jury would have us believe, is no matter for my judging. It is just one of those inexplicable riddles that must remain unsolved until the final solution of all things shall come. All I certainly know is that, in the very moment, in the very instant, of concluding those passes, he changed, and staggered, and fell down before us, dead. Chapter Jimmy Goggles the God. It isn't everyone who's been a god, said the sunburnt man. But it's happened to me, among other things. I intimated my sense of his condescension. It don't leave much for ambition, does it? Said the sunburnt man. I was one of those men who were saved from the ocean pioneer. Gummy, how time flies. It's 20 years ago. I doubt if you'll remember anything of the ocean pioneer. The name was familiar, and I tried to recall when and where I had read it. The ocean pioneer? Something about gold dust, I said vaguely, but the precise, that's it, he said. I in a beastly little channel's he hadn't no business in dodging pirates. It was before they'd put the kibosh on that business. And there had been volcanoes or something, and all the rocks was wrong. There's places about Bisuna, where you fair have to follow the rocks about to see where they're going next. Down she went in 20 fathoms before you could have dealt four whist, with £50,000 worth of gold aboard, it was said, in one form or another. Survivors? 3. I remember the case now, I said. There was something about salvage, but at the word salvage the sunburned man exploded into language so extraordinarily horrible that I stopped aghast. He came down to more ordinary swearing, and pulled himself up abruptly. Excuse me, he said, but salvage. He leant over towards me. I was in that job, he said. Tried to make myself a rich man, and got made a god instead. I've got my feelings, it ain't all jam being a god, said the sunburnt man, and for some time conversed by means of such pithy but unprogressive axioms. At last he took up his tale again. There was me, said the sunburnt man, and a seaman named Jacobs, and always, the mate of the ocean pioneer. And him it was that set the whole thing going. I remember him now, when we was in the jolly boat, suggesting it all to our minds just by one sentence. He was a wonderful hand at suggesting things. There was £40,000, apostrophe he said, on that ship, and it's for me to say, just where she went down. Apostrophe apostrophe it didn't need much brains to tumble to that. And he was the leader from the first to the last. He got hold of the Sanderses and their brig. They were brothers, and the brig was the Pride of Banya, and he it was bought the diving dress, a second-hand one with a compressed air apparatus instead of pumping. He'd have done the diving too, if it hadn't made him sick going down. And the salvage people were mucking about with a chart he'd cooked up, as solemn as could be, at Star Race, 120 miles away. I can tell you we was a happy lot aboard that brig, jokes and drink and bright hopes all the time. It all seemed so neat, and clean and straightforward, and what rough chaps call a cert. Apostrophe apostrophe and we used to speculate how the other blessed lot, the proper salvagers, who'd started 2 days before us, were getting on, until our sides fairly ached. We all messed together in the Sanders's cabin. It was a curious crew, all officers and no men, and there stood the diving dress waiting its turn. Young Sanders was a humorous sort of chap, and there certainly was something funny in the confounded thing's great fat head and its stare, and he made us see it too. Jimmy Goggles, apostrophe he used to call it, and talked to it like a Christian. Asked if he was married, and how Mrs. Goggles was, and all the little googleases. Fit to make you split. And every blessed day all of us used to drink the health of Jimmy Goggles in rum, and unscrew his eye, and pour a glass of rum in him, until, instead of that nasty Macintosheriness, he smelt as nice in his inside as a cask of rum. It was jolly times we had in those days, I can tell you little suspecting, poor chaps, what was a coming. We weren't going to throw away our chances by any blessed hurry, you know, and we spent a whole day sounding our way towards where the Ocean Pioneer had gone down, right between two chunks of ropey gray rock lava rocks that rose nearly out of the water. We had to lay off about half a mile to get a safe anchorage, and there was a thundering row who should stop on board. And there she lay just as he had gone down, so that you could see the top of the masts, that was still standing perfectly distinctly. The row ending in all coming in the boat. I went down in the diving dress on Friday morning directly it was light. What a surprise it was. I can see it all now quite distinctly. It was a queer looking place, and the light was just coming. People over here think every blessed place in the tropics is a flat shore and palm trees and surf, bless 'em. This place, for instance, wasn't a bit that way. Not common rocks they were, undermined by waves, but great curved banks like ironwork cinder heaps, with green slime below, and thorny shrubs and things just waving upon them here and there, and the water glassy calm and clear, and showing you a kind of dirty gray-black shine, with huge flaring red-brown weeds spreading motionless, and crawling and darting things going through it. And far away beyond the ditches, and pools and the heaps was a forest on the mountain flank, growing again after the fires and cinder showers of the last eruption. And the other way forest too, and a kind of broken, what is it? Amphitheater of black and rusty cinders rising out of it all, and the sea in a kind of bay in the middle. The dawn, I say, was just coming, and there wasn't much color about things, and not a human being but ourselves anywhere in sight up or down the channel. Except the Pride of Banya, lying out beyond a lump of rocks towards the line of the sea. Not a human being in sight, he repeated, and paused. I don't know where they came from, not a bit. And we were feeling so safe, that we were all alone, that poor young Sanders was a-singing. I was in Jimmy Goggles, all except the helmet. Easy, apostrophe says always, there's her mast. Apostrophe apostrophe and after I'd had just one squint over the gunwale, I caught up the bogey and almost tipped out as old Sanders, brought the boat round. When the windows were screwed, and everything was all right, I shut the valve from the air belt in order to help my sinking, and jumped overboard, feet foremost, for we hadn't a ladder. I left the boat pitching, and all of them staring down into the water after me, as my head sank down into the weeds and blackness that lay about the mast. I suppose nobody, not the most cautious chap in the world, would have bothered about a lookout at such a desolate place. It stunk of solitude. Of course you must understand that I was a greenhorn at diving. None of us were divers. We'd had to muck about with the thing to get the way of it, and this was the first time I'd been deep. It feels damnable. Your ears hurt beastly. I don't know if you've ever hurt yourself yawning or sneezing, but it takes you like that, only 10 times worse. And a pain over the eyebrows here splitting and a feeling like influenza in the head. And it isn't all heaven in your lungs and things. And going down feels like the beginning of a lift, only it keeps on. And you can't turn your head to see what's above you, and you can't get a fair squint at what's happening to your feet without bending down something painful. And being deep it was dark, let alone the blackness of the ashes and mud that formed the bottom. It was like going down out of the dawn back into the night, so to speak. The mast came up like a ghost out of the black, and then a lot of fishes, and then a lot of flapping red seaweed, and then whack I came with a kind of dull bang on the deck of the Ocean Pioneer, and the fishes, that had been feeding on the dead rose about me like a swarm of flies from road stuff in summertime. I turned on the compressed air again, for the suit was a bit thick, and Macintoshery after all, in spite of the rum, and stood recovering myself. It struck coolish down there, and that helped take off the stuffiness a bit. When I began to feel easier, I started looking about me. It was an extraordinary sight. Even the light was extraordinary, a kind of ready-colored twilight, on account of the streamers of seaweed that floated up on either side of the ship. And far overhead just a moony, deep green blue. The deck of the ship, except for a slight list to starboard, was level, and lay all dark and long between the weeds, clear except where the masts had snapped when she rolled, and vanishing into black night towards the forecastle. There wasn't any dead on the decks, most were in the weeds alongside, I suppose. But afterwards I found 2 skeletons lying in the passengers' cabins, where death had come to them. It was curious to stand on that deck, and recognize it all, bit by bit. A place against the rail, where I'd been fond of smoking by starlight, and the corner where an old chap from Sydney used to flirt with a widow we had aboard. A comfortable couple they'd been, only a month ago, and now you couldn't have got a meal for a baby crab off either of them. I've always had a bit of a philosophical turn, and I dare say I spent the best part of 5 minutes in such thoughts, before I went below to find where the blessed dust was stored. It was slow work hunting, feeling it was for the most part, pitchy dark, with confusing blue gleams down the companion. And there were things moving about, a dab at my glass once, and once a pinch at my leg. Crabs, I expect. I kicked a lot of loose stuff that puzzled me, and stooped and picked up something all knobs and spikes. What do you think? Backbone. But I never had any particular feeling for bones. We had talked the affair over pretty thoroughly, and always knew just where the stuff was stowed. I found it that trip. I lifted a box one end an inch or more. He broke off in his story. I've lifted it, he said, as near as that. 40,000 pounds worth of pure gold. Gold. I shouted inside my helmet as a kind of cheer and hurt my ears. I was getting confounded stuffy and tired by this time. I must have been down 25 minutes or more, and I thought this was good enough. I went up the companion again, and as my eyes came up flush with the deck, a thundering great crab gave a kind of hysterical jump, and went scuttling off sideways. Quite a start it gave me. I stood up clear on deck, and shut the valve behind the helmet, to let the air accumulate to carry me up again. I noticed a kind of whacking from above, as though they were hitting the water with an oar, but I didn't look up. I fancied they were signaling me to come up. And then something shot down by me, something heavy, and stood a quiver in the planks. I looked, and there was a long knife I'd seen young Sanders handling. Thinks I, he's dropped it, and I was still calling him this kind of fool, and that Ford might have hurt me serious when I began to lift and drive up towards the daylight. Just about the level of the top spars of the Ocean Pioneer, whack. I came against something sinking down, and a boot knocked in front of my helmet. Then something else, struggling frightful. It was a big weight atop of me, whatever it was, and moving and twisting about. I'd have thought it a big octopus, or some such thing, if it hadn't been for the boot. But octopuses don't wear boots. It was all in a moment, of course. I felt myself sinking down again, and I threw my arms about to keep steady, and the whole lot rolled free of me, and shot down as I went up, he paused. I saw young Sanders' face, over a naked black shoulder, and a spear driven clean through his neck, and out of his mouth and neck, what looked like spurts of pink smoke in the water. And down they went clutching one another, and turning over, and both too far gone to leave go. And in another second my helmet came a whack, fit to split, against the nigger's canoe. It was niggers. Two canoes full. It was lively times, I tell you. Overboard came always with three spears in him. There was the legs of three or four black chaps kicking about me in the water. I couldn't see much, but I saw the game was up at a glance, gave my valve a tremendous twist, and went bubbling down again after poor always, in as awful a state of scare and astonishment as you can well imagine. I passed young Sanders and the nigger going up again, and struggling still a bit, and in another moment I was standing in the dim again on the deck of the Ocean Pioneer. Gummy, apostrophe thinks I, here's a fix. Apostrophe niggers? At first I couldn't see anything for it, but stifle below or stabs above. I didn't properly understand how much air there was to last me, but I didn't feel like standing very much more of it down below. I was hot, and frightfully heady quite apart from the blue funk I was in. We'd never repined with these beastly natives, filthy Papuan beasts. It wasn't any good, coming up where I was, but I had to do something. On the spur of the moment, I clambered over the side of the brig and landed among the weeds, and set off through the darkness as fast as I could. I just stopped once and knelt, and twisted back my head in the helmet, and had a look up. It was a most extraordinary bright green-blue above, and the two canoes and the boat floating there very small, and distant like a kind of twisted H. And it made me feel sick to squint up at it, and think what the pitching and swaying of the three meant. It was just about the most horrible 10 minutes I ever had, blundering about in that darkness, pressure something awful, like being buried in sand. Pain across the chest, sick with funk, and breathing nothing as it seemed, but the smell of rum and Macintosh. Gummy. After a bit, I found myself going up a steepish sort of slope. I had another squint to see if anything was visible of the canoes and boats, and then kept on. I stopped with my head a foot from the surface, and tried to see where I was going, but, of course, nothing was to be seen but the reflection of the bottom. Then out I dashed like knocking my head through a mirror. Directly I got my eyes out of the water, I saw I'd come up a kind of beach near the forest. I had a look round, but the natives and the brig were both hidden by a big, hummocky heap of twisted lava. The born fool in me suggested a run for the woods. I didn't take the helmet off, but eased open one of the windows, and, after a bit of a pant, went on out of the water. You'd hardly imagine how clean and light the air tasted. Of course, with 4 inches of lead in your boot soles, and your head in a copper knob the size of a football, and been 35 minutes underwater, you don't break any records running. I ran like a plowboy going to work. And halfway to the trees I saw a dozen niggers or more, coming out in a gaping, astonished sort of way to meet me. I just stopped dead, and cursed myself for all the fools out of London. I had about as much chance of cutting back to the water as a turned turtle. I just screwed up my window again, to leave my hands free, and waited for them. There wasn't anything else for me to do. but they didn't come on very much. I began to suspect why. Jimmy Goggles, apostrophe I says, it's your beauty does it. Apostrophe I was inclined to be a little lightheaded, I think, with all these dangers about and the change in the pressure of the blessed air. Who are ye staring at? Apostrophe I said, as if the savages could hear me. What do you take me for? I'm hanged if I don't give you something to stare at, apostrophe I said, and with that I screwed up the escape valve, and turned on the compressed air from the belt, until I was swelled out like a blown frog. Regular imposing it must have been. I'm blessed if they'd come on a step, and presently one, and then another went down on their hands and knees. They didn't know what to make of me, and they was doing the extra polite, which was very wise and reasonable of them. I had half a mind to edge back seaward and cut and run, but it seemed too hopeless. A step back, and they'd have been after me. And out of sheer desperation I began to march towards them up the beach, with slow heavy steps, and waving my blown-out arms about, in a dignified manner. And inside of me, I was singing as small as a tomtit. But there's nothing like a striking appearance to help a man over a difficulty, I've found that before and since. People like ourselves, who are up to diving dresses by the time we're 7, can scarcely imagine the effect of one on a simple-minded savage. One or two of these niggers cut and run, the others started in a great hurry trying to knock their brains out on the ground. And on I went as slow and solemn and silly-looking and artful as a jobbing plumber. It was evident they took me for something immense. Then up jumped one and began pointing, making extraordinary gestures to me as he did so, and all the others began sharing their attention between me and something out at sea. What's the matter now? Apostrophe I said. I turned slowly on account of my dignity, and there I saw, coming round a point, the poor old Pride of Banya towed by a couple of canoes. The sight fairly made me sick. But they evidently expected some recognition, so I waved my arms in a striking sort of non-committal manner. And then I turned and stalked on towards the trees again. At that time I was praying like mad, I remember, over and over again. Lord help me through with it. Lord help me through with it. Apostrophe it's only fools who know nothing of dangers can afford to laugh at praying. But these niggers weren't going to let me walk through and away like that. They started a kind of bowing dance about me, and sort of pressed me to take a pathway that lay through the trees. It was clear to me, they didn't take me for a British citizen, whatever else they thought of me, and for my own part I was never less anxious to own up to the old country. You'd hardly believe it, perhaps, unless you're familiar with savages, but these poor misguided, ignorant creatures took me straight to their kind of joss place to present me to the blessed old black stone there. By this time I was beginning to sort of realize the depth of their ignorance, and directly I set eyes on this deity I took my cue. I started a baritone howl, wow wow, apostrophe very long on one note, and began waving my arms about a lot, and then very slowly and ceremoniously turned their image over on its side and sat down on it. I wanted to sit down badly, for diving dresses ain't much wear in the tropics. Or, to put it different like, they're a sight too much. It took away their breath, I could see, my sitting on their jaws. But in less time than a minute they made up their minds, and were hard at work worshipping me. And I can tell you I felt a bit relieved to see things turning out so well, in spite of the weight on my shoulders and feet. But what made me anxious was what the chaps in the canoes might think when they came back. If they'd seen me in the boat, before I went down, and without the helmet on, for they might have been spying and hiding, since overnight they would very likely take a different view from the others. I was in a deuce of a stew about that 4 hours, as it seemed, until the shindy of the arrival began. But they took it down, the whole blessed village took it down. At the cost of sitting up stiff and stern, as much like those sitting Egyptian images one sees as I could manage, for pretty nearly 12 hours, I should guess at least, on end, I got over it. You'd hardly think what it meant in that heat and stink. I don't think any of them dreamt of the man inside. I was just a wonderful leathery great joss that had come up with luck out of the water. But the fatigue, the heat, the beastly closeness, the Macintosheriness and the rum, and the fuss, they lit a stinking fire on a kind of lava slab there was before me, and brought in a lot of gory muck, the worst parts of what they were feasting on outside, the beasts, and burned it all in my honor. I was getting a bit hungry, but I understand now how gods managed to do without eating, what with the smell of burnt offerings about them. And they brought in a lot of the stuff they'd got off the brig, and, among other stuff, what I was a bit relieved to see, the kind of pneumatic pump that was used for the compressed air affair, and then a lot of chaps and girls came in and danced about me something disgraceful. It's extraordinary the different ways different people have of showing respect. If I'd had a hatchet handy, I'd have gone for the lot of them. They made me feel that wild. All this time I sat as stiff as company, not knowing anything better to do. And at last, when nightfall came, and the Waddle Joss House place got a bit too shadowy for their taste, all these here savages are afraid of the dark, you know, and I started a sort of moo noise. They built big bonfires outside, and left me alone in peace in the darkness of my hut, free to unscrew my windows a bit, and think things over, and feel just as bad as I liked. And, Lord, I was sick. I was weak and hungry, and my mind kept on behaving like a beetle on a pin. Tremendous activity and nothing done at the end of it. Come round just where it was before. There was sorrowing for the other chaps, beastly drunkards certainly, but not deserving such a fate, and young Sanders with the spear through his neck wouldn't go out of my mind. There was the treasure down there in the Ocean Pioneer, and how one might get it, and hide it somewhere safer, and get away, and come back for it. And there was the puzzle, where to get anything to eat. I tell you, I was fair rambling. I was afraid to ask by signs for food, for fear of behaving too human, and so there I sat and hungered until very near the dawn. Then the village got a bit quiet, and I couldn't stand it any longer, and I went out, and got some stuff like artichokes in a bowl and some sour milk. What was left of these I put away among the other offerings, just to give them a hint of my tastes. And in the morning they came to worship, and found me sitting up stiff, and respectable on their previous god, just as they'd left me overnight. I'd got my back against the central pillar of the hut, and, practically, I was asleep. And that's how I became a god among the heathen, a false god no doubt, and blasphemous, but one can't always pick and choose. Now, I don't want to crack myself up as a god beyond my merits, but I must confess that, while I was god to these people, they was extraordinarily successful. I don't say there's anything in it, mind you. They won a battle with another tribe. I got a lot of offerings I didn't want through it. They had wonderful fishing, and their crop of pearl was exceptional fine. And they counted the capture of the brig among the benefits I brought them. I must say I don't think that was a poor record for a perfectly new hand. And, though perhaps you'd scarcely credit it, I was the tribal god of those beastly savages for pretty nearly 4 months. What else could I do, man? But I didn't wear that diving dress all the time. I made them rig me up a sort of holy of holies, and a deuce of a time I had too, making them understand what it was I wanted them to do. That indeed was the great difficulty, making them understand my wishes. I couldn't let myself down by talking their lingo badly, even if I'd been able to speak at all, and I couldn't go flapping a lot of gestures at them. So I drew pictures in sand and sat down beside them, and hooted like 1 o'clock. Sometimes they did the things I wanted all right, and sometimes they did them all wrong. They was always very willing, certainly. All the while I was puzzling how I was to get the confounded business settled. Every night before the dawn I used to march out in full rig, and go off to a place where I could see the channel in which the ocean pioneer lay sunk, and once even, one moonlight night, I tried to walk out to her, but the weeds and rocks and dark clean beat me. I didn't get back till full day, and then I found all those silly niggers out on the beach praying their sea god to return to them. I was that vexed and tired, messing and tumbling about, and coming up and going down again, I could have punched their silly heads all round when they started rejoicing. I'm hanged if I like so much ceremony. And then came the missionary. That missionary. It was in the afternoon, and I was sitting in state in my outer temple place, sitting on that old black stone of theirs when he came. I heard a row outside and jabbering, and then his voice speaking to an interpreter. They worship stocks and stones, apostrophe he said, and I knew what was up, in a flash. I had one of my windows out for comfort, and I sang out straight away on the spur of the moment. Stocks and stones, apostrophe I says. You come inside, apostrophe I says, and I'll punch your blooming head. Apostrophe there was a kind of silence and more jabbering, and in he came, Bible in hand, after the manner of them a little sandy chap in specs and a pith helmet. I flatter myself, that me sitting there in the shadows, with my copper head and my big goggles, struck him a bit of a heap at first. Well, apostrophe I says, how's the trade in calico, for I don't hold with missionaries. I had a lark with that missionary. He was a raw hand, and quite outclassed with a man like me. He gasped out who was I, and I told him to read the inscription at my feet, if he wanted to know. Down he goes to read, and his interpreter, being of course as superstitious as any of them, took it as an act of worship, and plumped down like a shot. All my people gave a howl of triumph, and there wasn't any more business to be done in my village after that journey, not by the likes of him. But, of course, I was a fool, to choke him off like that. If I'd had any sense I should have told him straight away of the treasure, and taken him into company I've no doubt he'd have come into company. A child, with a few hours to think it over, could have seen the connection between my diving dress, and the loss of the ocean pioneer. A week after he left I went out one morning, and saw the Motherhood, the Savers ship from Star Race, towing up the channel and sounding. The whole blessed game was up, and all my trouble thrown away. Gummy! How wild I felt! And guying it in that stinking silly dress. 4 months. The sunburnt man's story degenerated again. Tee, think of it, he said, when he emerged to linguistic purity once more. £40,000 worth of gold. Did the little missionary come back? I asked. Oh, yes. Bless him. And he pledged his reputation there was a man inside the god, and started out to see as much with tremendous ceremony. But there wasn't, he got sold again. I always did hate scenes and explanations, and long before he came I was out of it all, going home to Banya along the coast, hiding in bushes by day, and thieving food from the villages by night. Only weapon, a spear. No clothes, no money. Nothing. My face was my fortune, as the saying is. And just a squeak of £8,000 of gold, fifth share. But the natives cut up Rusty, thank goodness, because they thought it was him had driven their luck away. Chapter The New Accelerator. Certainly, if ever a man found a guinea when he was looking for a pin, it is my good friend Professor Gibbon. I have heard before of investigators overshooting the mark, but never quite to the extent that he has done. He has really, this time at any rate, without any touch of exaggeration in the phrase, found something to revolutionize human life. And that when he was simply seeking an all-round nervous stimulant to bring languid people up to the stresses of these pushful days. I have tasted the stuff now several times, and I cannot do better than describe the effect the thing had on me. That there are astonishing experiences in store for all in search of new sensations will become apparent enough. Professor Gibbon, as many people know, is my neighbor in Folkestone. Unless my memory plays me a trick, His portrait at various ages has already appeared in the Strand magazine, I think late in 1899, but I am unable to look it up, because I have lent that volume to someone who has never sent it back. The reader may, perhaps, recall the high forehead and the singularly long black eyebrows that give such a Mephistophelian touch to his face. He occupies one of those pleasant little detached houses in the mixed style that make the western end of the Upper Sandgate Road so interesting. His is the one with the Flemish gables and the Moorish portico, and it is in the little room with the mullioned bay window that he works when he is down here, and in which of an evening we have so often smoked and talked together. He is a mighty jester, but, besides, he likes to talk to me about his work. He is one of those men who find a help and stimulus in talking, and so I have been able to follow the conception of the new accelerator right up from a very early stage. Of course, the greater portion of his experimental work is not done in Folkestone, but in Gower Street, in the fine new laboratory next to the hospital that he has been the first to use. As everyone knows, or at least as all intelligent people know, the special department in which Gibbon has gained so great and deserved a reputation among physiologists is the action of drugs upon the nervous system. Upon soporifics, sedatives, and anesthetics he is, I am told, unequaled. He is also a chemist of considerable eminence, and I suppose in the subtle and complex jungle of riddles that centers about the ganglion cell and the axis fiber there are little cleared places of his making, little glades of illumination, that, until he sees fit to publish his results, are still inaccessible to every other living man. And in the last few years he has been particularly assiduous upon this question of nervous stimulants, and already, before the discovery of the new accelerator, very successful with them. Medical science has to thank him for at least three distinct and absolutely safe invigorators of unrivaled value to practicing men. In cases of exhaustion, the preparation known as Gibbon's Bee Syrup has, I suppose, saved more lives already than any lifeboat round the coast. But none of these little things begin to satisfy me yet, he told me nearly a year ago. Either they increase the central energy without affecting the nerves, or they simply increase the available energy by lowering the nervous conductivity, and all of them are unequal and local in their operation. One wakes up the heart and viscera and leaves the brain stupefied. One gets at the brain champagne fashion, and does nothing good for the solar plexus, and what I want and what, if it's an earthly possibility, I mean to have is a stimulant that stimulates all round, that wakes you up for a time from the crown of your head to the tip of your great toe, and makes you go two or even three to everybody else's one. Eh? That's the thing I'm after. It would tire a man, I said. Not a doubt of it. And you'd eat double or treble and all that. But just think what the thing would mean. Imagine yourself with a little file like this. He held up a little bottle of green glass and marked his points with it. And in this precious file is the power to think twice as fast, move twice as quickly, do twice as much work in a given time as you could otherwise do. But is such a thing possible? I believe so. If it isn't, I've wasted my time for a year. These various preparations of the hypophosphites, for example, seem to show that something of the sort. Even if it was only one and a half times as fast it would do. It would do, I said. If you were a statesman in a corner, for example, time rushing up against you, something urgent to be done, eh? He could dose his private secretary, I said. And gain double time. And think if you, for example, wanted to finish a book. Usually, I said, I wish I'd never begun them. Or a doctor, driven to death, wants to sit down and think out a case. Or a barrister or a man cramming for an examination. Worth a guinea a drop, said I, and more to men like that. And in a duel, again, said Gibbon, where it all depends on your quickness in pulling the trigger. Or in fencing, I echoed. You see, said Gibbon, If I get it as an all-round thing, it will really do you no harm at all, except perhaps to an infinitesimal degree it brings you nearer old age. You will just have lived twice to other people's once, I suppose. I meditated. In a duel, it would be fair? That's a question for the seconds, said Gibbon. I harked back further. And you really think such a thing is possible? I said. As possible, said Gibbon, and glanced at something that went throbbing by the window, as a motor bus. As a matter of fact, he paused and smiled at me deeply, and tapped slowly on the edge of his desk with the green file. I think I know the stuff. Already I've got something coming. The nervous smile upon his face betrayed the gravity of his revelation. He rarely talked of his actual experimental work, unless things were very near the end. And it may be I shouldn't be surprised, it may even do the thing at a greater rate than twice. It will be rather a big thing, I hazarded. It will be, I think, rather a big thing. But I don't think he quite knew what a big thing it was to be, for all that. I remember we had several talks about the stuff after that. The new accelerator, he called it, and his tone about it grew more confident on each occasion. Sometimes he talked nervously of unexpected physiological results its use might have, and then he would get a little unhappy. At others he was frankly mercenary, and we debated long and anxiously how the preparation might be turned to commercial account. It's a good thing, said Gibbon, a tremendous thing. I know I'm giving the world something, and I think it only reasonable we should expect the world to pay. The dignity of science is all very well, but I think somehow I must have the monopoly of the stuff for, say, 10 years. I don't see why all the fun in life should go to the dealers in ham. My own interest in the coming drug certainly did not wane in the time. I have always had a queer little twist towards metaphysics in my mind. I have always been given to paradoxes about space and time, and it seemed to me that Gibbon was really preparing no less than the absolute acceleration of life. Suppose a man repeatedly dosed with such a preparation. He would live an active, and record life indeed, but he would be an adult at 11, middle-aged at 25, and by 30 well on the road to senile decay. It seemed to me that, so far Gibbon was only going to do for anyone who took his drug exactly what nature has done for the Jews and Orientals, who are men in their teens and aged by 50, and quicker in thought and act than we are all the time. The marvel of drugs has always been great to my mind. You can madden a man, calm a man, make him incredibly strong, and alerter a helpless log. Quicken his passion and delay that, all by means of drugs, and here was a new miracle, to be added to this strange armory of files the doctors use. But Gibbon was far too eager upon his technical points to enter very keenly into my aspect of the question. It was the 7th or 8th of August when he told me the distillation that would decide his failure or success for a time was going forward as we talked, and it was on the 10th that he told me the thing was done and the new accelerator a tangible reality in the world. I met him as I was going up the Sandgate Hill towards Folkestone. I think I was going to get my hair cut, and he came hurrying down to meet me. I suppose he was coming to my house to tell me at once of his success. I remember that his eyes were unusually bright, and his face flushed, and I noted even then the swift alacrity of his step. "It's done," he cried, and gripped my hand, speaking very fast. "It's more than done. Come up to my house and see." "Really? Really," he shouted. "Incredibly. Come up and see. And it does twice? It does more, much more. It scares me. Come up and see the stuff. Taste it. Try it. It's the most amazing stuff on earth." He gripped my arm, and, walking at such a pace that he forced me into a trot, went shouting with me up the hill. A whole charabanc full of people turned and stared at us in unison after the manner of people in charabanc. It was one of those hot, clear days that Folkestone sees so much of, every color incredibly bright, and every outline hard. There was a breeze, of course, but not so much breeze as sufficed under these conditions to keep me cool and dry. I panted for mercy. I'm not walking fast, am I? Cried Gibbon, and slackened his pace to a quick march. You've been taking some of this stuff, I puffed. No, he said. At the utmost a drop of water that stood in a beaker from which I had washed out the last traces of the stuff. I took some last night, you know. But that is ancient history now. And it goes twice? I said, nearing his doorway in a grateful perspiration. It goes 1,000 times, many 1,000 times, cried Gibbon, with a dramatic gesture, flinging open his early English carved oak gate. Phew, said I, and followed him to the door. I don't know how many times it goes, he said, with his latch key in his hand. And you, it throws all sorts of light on nervous physiology, it kicks the theory of vision into a perfectly new shape. ... Heaven knows how many 1,000 times. We'll try all that after. The thing is to try the stuff now. Try the stuff? I said, as we went along the passage. Rather, said Gibbon, turning on me in his study. See, there it is in that little green file there. Unless you happen to be afraid? I am a careful man by nature, and only theoretically adventurous. I was afraid. But on the other hand there is pride. Well, I haggled. Why you say you've tried it? I've tried it, he said, and I don't look hurt by it, do I? I don't even look livery, and I feel, I sat down. Gee, give me the potion, I said. If the worst comes to the worst it will save, having my hair cut, and that I think, is one of the most hateful duties of a civilized man. How do you take the mixture? With water, said Gibbon, whacking down a carafe. He stood up in front of his desk, and regarded me in his easy chair. His manner was suddenly affected by a touch of the Harley Street specialist. It's rum stuff, you know, he said. I made a gesture with my hand. I must warn you in the first place, as soon as you've got it down to shut your eyes, and open them very cautiously in a minute or so's time. One still sees. The sense of vision is a question of length of vibration, and not of multitude of impacts, but there's a kind of shock to the retina, a nasty giddy confusion just at the time, if the eyes are open. Keep 'em shut. Shut, I said. Gee, good. And the next thing is, keep still. Don't begin to whack about. You may fetch something a nasty rap if you do. Remember, you will be going 1,000 times faster than you ever did before. Heart, lungs, muscles, brain, everything, and you will hit hard without knowing it. You won't know it, you know. You'll feel just as you do now. Only everything in the world will seem to be going ever so many 1,000 times slower than it ever went before. That's what makes it so deuced queer. Lore, I said. And you mean, you'll see, said he, and took up a little measure. He glanced at the material on his desk. Gee, glasses, he said, water. All here. Mustn't take too much for the first attempt. The little phial glucked out its precious contents. Don't forget what I told you, he said, turning the contents of the measure into a glass in the manner of an Italian waiter measuring whiskey. Sit with the eyes tightly shut, and in absolute stillness for 2 minutes, he said. Then you will hear me speak. He added an inch or so of water to the little dose in each glass. By the by, he said, don't put your glass down. Keep it in your hand and rest your hand on your knee. Yes, so. And now, he raised his glass. The new accelerator, I said. The new accelerator, he answered, and we touched glasses and drank, and instantly I closed my eyes. You know that blank non-existence into which one drops, when one has taken as. For an indefinite interval it was like that. Then I heard Gibbon telling me to wake up, and I stirred and opened my eyes. There he stood as he had been standing, glass still in hand. It was empty, that was all the difference. Well? Said I, nothing out of the way? Nothing. A slight feeling of exhilaration, perhaps. Nothing more. Sounds? Things are still, I said. Be by Jove. Yes. They are still. Except the sort of faint pat, patter, like rain falling on different things. What is it? Analyzed sounds, I think he said, but I am not sure. He glanced at the window. Have you ever seen a curtain before a window fixed in that way before? I followed his eyes, and there was the end of the curtain, frozen, as it were, corner high, in the act of flapping briskly in the breeze. No, said I, that's odd. And here, he said, and opened the hand that held the glass. Naturally I winced, expecting the glass to smash. But so far from smashing it did not even seem to stir. It hung in mid-air motionless. Roughly speaking, said Gibbon, an object in these latitudes falls 16 feet in the first second. This glass is falling 16 feet in a second now. Only, you see, it hasn't been falling yet for the hundredth part of a second. That gives you some idea of the pace of my accelerator. And he waved his hand round and round, over and under the slowly sinking glass. Finally, he took it by the bottom, pulled it down, and placed it very carefully on the table. "Yea," he said to me, and laughed. "That seems all right," I said, and began very gingerly to raise myself from my chair. I felt perfectly well, very light and comfortable, and quite confident in my mind. I was going fast all over. My heart, for example, was beating 1,000 times a second. But that caused me no discomfort at all. I looked out of the window. An immovable cyclist, head down and with a frozen puff of dust behind his driving wheel, scorched to overtake a galloping char-a-banc that did not stir. I gaped in amazement at this incredible spectacle. Gibbon, I cried, how long will this confounded stuff last? Heaven knows, he answered. Last time I took it, I went to bed and slept it off. I tell you, I was frightened. It must have lasted some minutes, I think it seemed like hours. But after a bit it slows down rather suddenly, I believe. I was proud to observe that I did not feel frightened, I suppose, because there were two of us. Why shouldn't we go out? I asked. Why not? They'll see us. Not they. Goodness, no. Why, we shall be going 1,000 times faster than the quickest conjuring trick that was ever done. Come along. Which way shall we go? Window, or door? And out by the window we went. Assuredly of all the strange experiences that I have ever had, or imagined, or read of other people having or imagining, that little raid I made with Gibbon on the Folkestone Lees, under the influence of the new accelerator, was the strangest and maddest of all. We went out by his gate into the road, and there we made a minute examination of the statuesque passing traffic. The tops of the wheels and some of the legs of the horses of this char-a-banc, the end of the whiplash, and the lower jaw of the conductor who was just beginning to yawn were perceptibly in motion, but all the rest of the lumbering conveyance seemed still, and quite noiseless, except for a faint rattling that came from one man's throat. And as parts of this frozen edifice there were a driver, you know, and a conductor, and 11 people. The effect as we walked about the thing began by being madly queer, and ended by being disagreeable. There they were, people like ourselves, and yet not like ourselves, frozen in careless attitudes, caught in mid-gesture. A girl and a man smiled at one another, a leering smile that threatened to last forevermore. A woman in a floppy capeline rested her arm on the rail, and stared at Gibbon's house with the unwinking stare of eternity. A man stroked his mustache like a figure of wax, and another stretched a tiresome stiff hand with extended fingers towards his loosened hat. We stared at them, we laughed at them, we made faces at them, and then a sort of disgust of them came upon us, and we turned away, and walked round in front of the cyclist towards the Lees. Goodness! Cried Gibbon, suddenly. Look there! He pointed, and there at the tip of his finger, and sliding down the air with wings flapping slowly, and at the speed of an exceptionally languid snail was a bee. And so we came out upon the Lees. There the thing seemed madder than ever. The band was playing in the upper stand, though all the sound it made for us was a low-pitched, wheezy rattle, a sort of prolonged last sigh that passed at times into a sound like the slow, muffled ticking of some monstrous clock. Frozen people stood erect, strange, silent, self-conscious-looking dummies hung unstably in mid-stride, promenading upon the grass. I passed close to a little poodle dog suspended in the act of leaping, and watched the slow movement of his legs as he sank to earth. "Eh, Lord, look here!" cried Gibbon, and we halted for a moment before a magnificent person in white faint-striped flannels, white shoes, and a Panama hat, who turned back to wink at two gaily dressed ladies he had passed. A wink, studied with such leisurely deliberation as we could afford, is an unattractive thing. It loses any quality of alert gaiety, and one remarks that the winking eye does not completely close, that under its drooping lid appears the lower edge of an eyeball, and a little line of white. "H heaven give me memory," said I, "and I will never wink again." "Or smile," said Gibbon, with his eye on the lady's answering teeth. "It's infernally hot, somehow," said I. "Let's go slower." "Oh, come along," said Gibbon. We picked our way among the bath chairs in the path. Many of the people sitting in the chair seemed almost natural in their passive poses, but the contorted scarlet of the bandsman was not a restful thing to see. A purple-faced little gentleman was frozen in the midst of a violent struggle to refold his newspaper against the wind. There were many evidences that all these people in their sluggish way were exposed to a considerable breeze, a breeze that had no existence so far as our sensations went. We came out, and walked a little way from the crowd, and turned and regarded it. To see all that multitude changed, to a picture, smitten rigid, as it were, into the semblance of realistic wax, was impossibly wonderful. It was absurd, of course, but it filled me with an irrational, an exultant sense of superior advantage. Consider the wonder of it. All that I had said, and thought, and done since the stuff had begun to work in my veins had happened, so far as those people, so far as the world in general went, in the twinkling of an eye. "Tea the new accelerator," I began, but Gibbon interrupted me. "There's that infernal old woman," he said.
"What old woman?"
"Lives next door to me," said Gibbon. "H has a lapdog that yaps. Gods! The temptation is strong." There is something very boyish and impulsive about Gibbon at times. Before I could expostulate with him, he had dashed forward, snatched the unfortunate animal out of visible existence, and was running violently with it towards the cliff of the Lees. It was most extraordinary. The little brute, you know, didn't bark or wriggle or make the slightest sign of vitality. It kept quite stiffly in an attitude of somnolent repose, and Gibbon held it by the neck. It was like running about with a dog of wood.
"Gee, Gibbon," I cried, "put it down." Then I said something else.
"If you run like that, Gibbon," I cried, "you'll set your clothes on fire. Your linen trousers are going brown as it is." He clapped his hand on his thigh, and stood hesitating on the verge.
"Gibbon," I cried, "coming up, put it down. This heat is too much. It's our running so. 2 or 3 miles a second. Friction of the air."
"What?" he said, glancing at the dog.
"Friction of the air," I shouted.
"Friction of the air. Going too fast. Like meteorites and things. Too hot. And, Gibbon. Gibbon. I'm all over pricking, and a sort of perspiration. You can see people stirring slightly. I believe the stuff's working off. Put that dog down."
"Eh?"
he said.
"It's working off," I repeated.
"You're too hot, and the stuff's working off. I'm wet through." He stared at me, then at the band, the wheezy rattle of whose performance was certainly going faster. Then with a tremendous sweep of the arm he hurled the dog away from him, and it went spinning upward, still inanimate, and hung at last over the grouped parasols of a knot of chattering people. Gibbon was gripping my elbow.
"By Jove," he cried. "I believe it is. A sort of odd pricking and hiss. That man's moving his pocket handkerchief. Perceptibly. We must get out of this sharp. But we could not get out of it sharply enough. Luckily, perhaps. For we might have run, and if we had run we should, I believe, have burst into flames. Almost certainly we should have burst into flames. You know we had neither of us thought of that. But before we could even begin to run the action of the drug had ceased. It was the business of a minute fraction of a second. The effect of the new accelerator passed like the drawing of a curtain, vanished in the movement of a hand. I heard Gibbon's voice in infinite alarm. Sit down, he said, and flop, down upon the turf at the edge of the lees I sat, scorching as I sat. There is a patch of burnt grass there still where I sat down. The whole stagnation seemed to wake up as I did so, the disarticulated vibration of the band rushed together into a blast of music, the promenaders put their feet down, and walked their ways, the papers and flags began flapping, smiles passed into words, the winker finished his wink, and went on his way complacently, and all the seated people moved and spoke. The whole world had come alive again, was going as fast as we were, or rather we were going no faster than the rest of the world. It was like slowing down as one comes into a railway station. Everything seemed to spin round for a second or two. I had the most transient feeling of nausea, and that was all. And the little dog which had seemed to hang for a moment, when the force of Gibbon's arm was expended fell with a swift acceleration clean through a lady's parasol. That was the saving of us. Unless it was for one corpulent old gentleman in a bath chair, who certainly did start at the sight of us, and afterwards regarded us at intervals with a darkly suspicious eye, and, finally, I believe, said something to his nurse about us, I doubt if a solitary person remarked our sudden appearance among them. Plop! We must have appeared abruptly. We ceased to smolder almost at once, though the turf beneath me was uncomfortably hot. The attention of everyone, including even the Amusements Association band, which on this occasion, for the only time in its history, got out of tune, was arrested by the amazing fact, and the still more amazing yapping and uproar caused by the fact that a respectable, overfed lapdog sleeping quietly to the east of the bandstand, should suddenly fall through the parasol of a lady on the west in a slightly singed condition due to the extreme velocity of its movements through the air. In these absurd days too, when we are all trying to be as psychic, and silly, and superstitious as possible. People got up and trod on other people, chairs were overturned, the Lee's policeman ran. How the matter settled itself I do not know. We were much too anxious to disentangle ourselves from the affair, and get out of range of the eye of the old gentleman in the bath chair to make minute inquiries. As soon as we were sufficiently cool, and sufficiently recovered from our giddiness and nausea and confusion of mind to do, so we stood up, and, skirting the crowd, directed our steps back along the road below the Metropole towards Gibbon's house. But amidst the din I heard very distinctly the gentleman who had been sitting beside the lady of the ruptured sunshade using quite unjustifiable threats and language to one of those chair attendants who have Inspector written on their caps. If you didn't throw the dog, he said, who did? The sudden return of movement and familiar noises, and our natural anxiety about ourselves, our clothes were still dreadfully hot, and the fronts of the thighs of Gibbon's white trousers were scorched a drabbish brown, prevented the minute observations I should have liked to make on all these things. Indeed, I really made no observations of any scientific value on that return. The bee, of course, had gone. I looked for that cyclist, but he was already out of sight as we came into the upper Sanjay Road, or hidden from us by traffic. The Chare Bank, however, with its people now all alive and stirring, was clattering along at a spanking pace almost abreast of the nearer church. We noted, however, that the window sill on which we had stepped, in getting out of the house was slightly singed, and that the impressions of our feet on the gravel of the path were unusually deep. So it was I had my first experience of the new accelerator. Practically we had been running about and saying, and doing all sorts of things in the space of a second or so of time. We had lived half an hour, while the band had played, perhaps, two bars. But the effect it had upon us was that the whole world had stopped for our convenient inspection. Considering all things, and particularly considering our rashness in venturing out of the house, the experience might certainly have been much more disagreeable than it was. It showed, no doubt, that Gibbon has still much to learn before his preparation is a manageable convenience, but its practicability it certainly demonstrated beyond all cavil. Since that adventure he has been steadily bringing its use under control, and I have several times, and without the slightest bad result, taken measured doses under his direction, though I must confess I have not yet ventured abroad again, while under its influence. I may mention, for example, that this story has been written at one sitting and without interruption, except for the nibbling of some chocolate, by its means. I began at 6:25, and my watch is now very nearly at the minute past the half hour. The convenience of securing a long, uninterrupted spell of work in the midst of a day full of engagements cannot be exaggerated. Gibbon is now working at the quantitative handling of his preparation, with a special reference to its distinctive effects upon different types of constitution. He then hopes to find a retarder with which to dilute its present rather excessive potency. The retarder will, of course, have the reverse effect to the accelerator. Used alone, it should enable the patient to spread a few seconds over many hours of ordinary time, and so to maintain an apathetic inaction, a glacier-like absence of alacrity, amidst the most animated or irritating surroundings. The two things together must necessarily work an entire revolution in civilized existence. It is the beginning of our escape from that time garment of which Carlyle speaks. While this accelerator will enable us to concentrate ourselves with tremendous impact upon any moment or occasion that demands our utmost sense and vigor, the retarder will enable us to pass in passive tranquility through infinite hardship and tedium. Perhaps I am a little optimistic about the retarder, which is indeed still to be discovered, but about the accelerator there is no possible sort of doubt whatever. Its appearance upon the market in a convenient, controllable, and assimilable form is a matter of the next few months. It will be obtainable of all chemists and druggists, in small green bottles, at a high, but, considering its extraordinary qualities, by no means excessive price. Gibbon's nervous accelerator it will be called, and he hopes to be able to supply it in three strengths. 1 in 200, 1 in 900, and 1 in 2000, distinguished by yellow, pink, and white labels respectively. No doubt its use renders a great number of very extraordinary things possible, for, of course, the most remarkable, and, possibly, even criminal proceedings may be effected with impunity by thus dodging, as it were, into the interstices of time. Like all potent preparations, it will be liable to abuse. We have, however, discussed this aspect of the question very thoroughly, and we have decided that this is purely a matter of medical jurisprudence and altogether outside our province. We shall manufacture and sell the accelerator, and, as for the consequences, we shall see. Chapter: Mr. Ledbetter's Vacation. My friend, Mr. Ledbetter, is a round-faced little man, whose natural mildness of eye is gigantically exaggerated when you catch the beam through his glasses, and whose deep, deliberate voice irritates irritable people. A certain elaborate clearness of enunciation has come with him to his present vicarage from his scholastic days, an elaborate clearness of enunciation and a certain nervous determination to be firm and correct upon all issues, important and unimportant alike. He is a sacerdotalist and a chess player, and suspected by many of the secret practice of the higher mathematics, creditable, rather than interesting things. His conversation is copious, and given much to needless detail. by many, indeed, his intercourse is condemned. To put it plainly, as oaring, and such have even done me the compliment, to wonder why I countenance him. But, on the other hand, there is a large faction who marvel at his countenancing such a disheveled, discreditable acquaintance as myself. Few appear to regard our friendship with equanimity. But that is because they do not know of the link that binds us, of my amiable connection via Jamaica with Mr. Ledbetter's past. About that past he displays an anxious modesty. I do not know what I should do, if it became known, he says, and repeats, impressively, I do not know what I should do. As a matter of fact, I doubt if he would do anything except get very red about the ears. But that will appear later, nor will I tell here of our first encounter, since, as a general rule, though I am prone to break it, the end of a story should come after, rather than before, the beginning. And the beginning of the story goes a long way back. Indeed, it is now nearly 20 years since fate, by a series of complicated and startling maneuvers, brought Mr. Ledbetter, so to speak, into my hands. In those days I was living in Jamaica, and Mr. Ledbetter was a schoolmaster in England. He was in orders, and already recognizably the same man that he is today. The same rotundity of visage, the same or similar glasses, and the same faint shadow of surprise in his resting expression. He was, of course, disheveled when I saw him, and his collar less of a collar than a wet bandage, and that may have helped to bridge the natural gulf between us, but of that, as I say, later. The business began at Hithergate on Sea, and simultaneously with Mr. Ledbetter's summer vacation. Thither he came for a greatly needed rest, with a bright brown portmanteau marked .WL, a new white and black straw hat, and two pairs of white flannel trousers. He was naturally exhilarated at his release from school, for he was not very fond of the boys he taught. After dinner he fell into a discussion with a talkative person established in the boarding house to which, acting on the advice of his aunt, he had resorted. This talkative person was the only other man in the house. Their discussion concerned the melancholy disappearance of wonder and adventure in these latter days, the prevalence of globe-trotting, the abolition of distance by steam and electricity, the vulgarity of advertisement, the degradation of men by civilization, and many such things. Particularly was the talkative person eloquent on the decay of human courage through security, a security Mr. Ledbetter rather thoughtlessly joined him in deploring. Mr. Ledbetter, in the first delight of emancipation from duty, and being anxious, perhaps, to establish a reputation for manly conviviality, partook, rather more freely than was advisable, of the excellent whiskey the talkative person produced. But he did not become intoxicated, he insists. He was simply eloquent beyond his sober wont, and with the finer edge gone from his judgment. And after that long talk of the brave old days, that were past forever, he went out into moonlit Hithergate alone, and up the cliff road, where the villas cluster together. He had bewailed, and now as he walked up the silent road he still bewailed, the fate that had called him to such an uneventful life as a pedagogue's. What a prosaic existence he led, so stagnant, so colorless. Secure, methodical, year in year out, what call was there for bravery? He thought enviously of those roving, medieval days, so near and so remote, of quests and spies and condottieri, and many a risky blade-drawing business. And suddenly came a doubt, a strange doubt, springing out of some chance thought of tortures, and destructive altogether of the position he had assumed that evening. Was he, Mr. Ledbetter, really, after all, so brave as he assumed? Would he really be so pleased to have railways, policemen, and security vanish suddenly from the earth? The talkative man had spoken enviously of crime. T. the burglar, he said, is the only true adventurer left on earth. Think of his single-handed fight against the whole civilized world. And Mr. Ledbetter had echoed his envy. T. they do have some fun out of life, Mr. Ledbetter had said. And about the only people who do. Just think how it must feel to wire a lawn. And he had laughed wickedly. Now, in this rancor intimacy of self-communion, he found himself instituting a comparison between his own brand of courage and that of the habitual criminal. He tried to meet these insidious questionings with blank assertion. I could do all that, said Mr. Ledbetter. I long to do all that. Only I do not give way to my criminal impulses. My moral courage restrains me. But he doubted, even while he told himself these things. Mr. Ledbetter passed a large villa standing by itself. Conveniently situated above a quiet practicable balcony was a window, gaping black, wide open. At the time he scarcely marked it, but the picture of it came with him, woven to his thoughts. He figured himself climbing up that balcony, crouching, plunging into that dark, mysterious interior. Be-ba! You would not dare, said the spirit of doubt. Am my duty to my fellow men forbids, said Mr. Ledbetter's self-respect. It was nearly 11, and the little seaside town was already very still. The whole world slumbered under the moonlight. Only one warm oblong of window blind far down the road spoke of waking life. He turned and came back slowly towards the villa of the open window. He stood for a time outside the gate, a battlefield of motives. Let us put things to the test, said Doubt. If for the satisfaction of these intolerable doubts, show that you dare go into that house. Commit a burglary in blank. That, at any rate, is no crime. Very softly he opened and shut the gate, and slipped into the shadow of the shrubbery. This is foolish, said Mr. Ledbetter's caution. I expected that, said Doubt. His heart was beating fast, but he was certainly not afraid. He was not afraid. He remained in that shadow for some considerable time. The ascent of the balcony, it was evident, would have to be done in a rush, for it was all in clear moonlight, and visible from the gate into the avenue. A trellis thinly set with young, ambitious climbing roses made the ascent ridiculously easy. There, in that black shadow by the stone vase of flowers, one might crouch, and take a closer view of this gaping breach in the domestic defenses, the open window. For a while Mr. Ledbetter was as still as the night, and then that insidious whiskey tipped the balance. He dashed forward. He went up the trellis with quick convulsive movements, swung his legs over the parapet of the balcony, and dropped panting in the shadow even as he had designed. He was trembling violently, short of breath, and his heart pumped noisily, but his mood was exultation. He could have shouted to find he was so little afraid. A happy line that he had learned from Will's Ephistopheles came into his mind as he crouched there. I feel like a cat on the tiles, he whispered to himself. It was far better than he had expected this adventurous exhilaration. He was sorry for all poor men to whom burglary was unknown. Nothing happened. He was quite safe. And he was acting in the bravest manner. And now for the window, to make the burglary complete. Must he dare do that? Its position above the front door defined it as a landing or passage, and there were no looking glasses, or any bedroom signs about it, or any other window on the first floor, to suggest the possibility of a sleeper within. For a time he listened under the ledge, then raised his eyes above the sill and peered in. Close at hand, on the pedestal, and a little startling at first, was a nearly life-size gesticulating bronze. He ducked, and after some time he peered again. Beyond was a broad landing, faintly gleaming. A flimsy fabric of bead curtain, very black and sharp, against a further window, a broad staircase, plunging into a gulf of darkness below, and another ascending to the second floor. He glanced behind him, but the stillness of the night was unbroken. See crime, he whispered, crime, and scrambled softly and swiftly over the sill into the house. His feet fell noiselessly on a mat of skin. He was a burglar indeed. He crouched for a time, all ears and peering eyes. Outside was a scampering and rustling, and for a moment he repented of his enterprise. a short IAO, a spitting, and a rush into silence, spoke reassuringly of cats. His courage grew. He stood up. Everyone was abed, it seemed. So easy is it to commit a burglary, if one is so minded. He was glad he had put it to the test. He determined to take some petty trophy, just to prove his freedom from any abject fear of the law, and depart the way he had come. He peered about him, and suddenly the critical spirit arose again. Burglars did far more than such mere elementary entrance as this. They went into rooms, they forced safes. Well, he was not afraid. He could not force safes, because that would be a stupid want of consideration for his hosts. But he would go into rooms, he would go upstairs. More. He told himself that he was perfectly secure. An empty house could not be more reassuringly still. He had to clench his hands, nevertheless, and summon all his resolution, before he began very softly, to ascend the dim staircase, pausing for several seconds between each step. Above was a square landing with one open and several closed doors, and all the house was still. For a moment he stood wondering what would happen if some sleeper woke suddenly and emerged. The open door showed a moonlit bedroom, the coverlet white and undisturbed. Into this room he crept in 3 interminable minutes, and took a piece of soap for his plunder, his trophy. He turned to descend even more softly than he had ascended. It was as easy as, hist, ... footsteps. On the gravel outside the house, and then the noise of a latchkey, the yawn and bang of a door, and the spitting of a match in the hall below. Mr. Ledbetter stood petrified by the sudden discovery of the folly upon which he had come. How on earth am I to get out of this? Said Mr. Ledbetter. The hall grew bright with a candle flame, some heavy object bumped against the umbrella stand, and feet were ascending the staircase. In a flash Mr. Ledbetter realized that his retreat was closed. He stood for a moment, a pitiful figure of penitent confusion. My goodness! What a fool I have been, he whispered, and then darted swiftly across the shadowy landing into the empty bedroom from which he had just come. He stood listening, quivering. The footsteps reached the first floor landing. Horrible thought! This was possibly the latecomer's room. Not a moment was to be lost. Mr. Ledbetter stooped beside the bed, thanked heaven for a valance, and crawled within its protection not 10 seconds too soon. He became motionless on hands and knees. The advancing candlelight appeared through the thinner stitches of the fabric, the shadows ran wildly about, and became rigid as the candle was put down. Lord, what a day! Said the newcomer, blowing noisily, and it seemed he deposited some heavy burthen on what Mr. Ledbetter, judging by the feet, decided to be a writing table. The unseen then went to the door and locked it, examined the fastenings of the windows carefully, and pulled down the blinds, and returning sat down upon the bed with startling ponderosity. What a day! He said. Good Lord! And blew again, and Mr. Ledbetter inclined to believe that the person was mopping his face. His boots were good stout boots. The shadows of his legs upon the valance suggested a formidable stoutness of aspect. After a time he removed some upper garments, a coat and waistcoat, Mr. Ledbetter inferred, and casting them over the rail of the bed remained breathing less noisily, and as it seemed cooling from a considerable temperature. At intervals he muttered to himself, and once he laughed softly. And Mr. Ledbetter muttered to himself, but he did not laugh. Oh, of all the foolish things, said Mr. Ledbetter. What on earth am I to do now? His outlook was necessarily limited. The minute apertures between the stitches of the fabric of the valance admitted a certain amount of light, but permitted no peeping. The shadows upon this curtain, save for those sharply defined legs, were enigmatical, and intermingled confusingly with the florid patterning of the chintz. Beneath the edge of the valance a strip of carpet was visible, and, by cautiously depressing his eye, Mr. Ledbetter found that this strip broadened until the whole area of the floor came into view. The carpet was a luxurious one, the room spacious, and, to judge by the casters, and so forth of the furniture, well equipped. What he should do he found it difficult to imagine. To wait until his person had gone to bed, and then, when he seemed to be sleeping, to creep to the door, unlock it, and bolt headlong for that balcony seemed the only possible thing to do. Would it be possible to jump from the balcony? The danger of it. When he thought of the chances against him, Mr. Ledbetter despaired. He was within an ace of thrusting forth his head beside the gentleman's legs, coughing if necessary to attract his attention, and then, smiling, apologizing and explaining his unfortunate intrusion by a few well-chosen sentences. But he found these sentences hard to choose. "And no doubt, sir, my appearance is peculiar," or, "I trust, sir, you will pardon my somewhat ambiguous appearance from beneath you," was about as much as he could get. Grave possibilities forced themselves on his attention. Suppose they did not believe him, what would they do to him? Would his unblemished high character count for nothing? Technically he was a burglar, beyond dispute. Following out this train of thought, he was composing a lucid apology for his technical crime I have committed, to be delivered before sentence in the dock, when the stout gentleman got up, and began walking about the room. He locked and unlocked drawers, and Mr. Ledbetter had a transient hope that he might be undressing. But, no. He seated himself at the writing table, and began to write, and then tear up documents. Presently the smell of burning cream-laid paper mingled with the odor of cigars in Mr. Ledbetter's nostrils. "The position I had assumed," said Mr. Ledbetter when he told me of these things, "was in many respects an ill-advised one. A transverse bar beneath the bed depressed my head unduly, and threw a disproportionate share of my weight upon my hands. After a time, I experienced what is called, I believe, a crick in the neck. The pressure of my hands on the coarsely stitched carpet speedily became painful. My knees, too, were painful, my trousers being drawn tightly over them. At that time I wore rather higher collars than I do now, 2.5 inches, in fact, and I discovered what I had not remarked before, that the edge of the one I wore was frayed slightly under the chin. But much worse than these things was an itching of my face, which I could only relieve by violent grimacing. I tried to raise my hand, but the rustle of the sleeve alarmed me. After a time I had to desist from this relief also, because happily in time I discovered that my facial contortions were shifting my glasses down my nose. Their fall would, of course, have exposed me, and as it was they came to rest in an oblique position of by no means stable equilibrium. In addition I had a slight cold, and an intermittent desire to sneeze or sniff caused me inconvenience. In fact, quite apart from the extreme anxiety of my position, my physical discomfort became in a short time very considerable indeed. But I had to stay there motionless, nevertheless. After an interminable time, there began a chinking sound. This deepened into a rhythm. Chink, 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 25 chinks, a rap on the writing table, and a grunt from the owner of the stout legs. It dawned upon Mr. Ledbetter that this chinking was the chinking of gold. He became incredulously curious as it went on. His curiosity grew. Already, if that was the case, this extraordinary man must have counted some hundreds of pounds. At last Mr. Ledbetter could resist it no longer, and he began very cautiously to fold his arms and lower his head to the level of the floor, in the hope of peeping under the valance. He moved his feet, and one made a slight scraping on the floor. Suddenly the chinking ceased. Mr. Ledbetter became rigid. After a while the chinking was resumed. Then it ceased again, and everything was still, except Mr. Ledbetter's heart. That organ seemed to him to be beating like a drum. The stillness continued. Mr. Ledbetter's head was now on the floor, and he could see the stout legs as far as the shins. They were quite still. The feet were resting on the toes and drawn back, as it seemed, under the chair of the owner. Everything was quite still. Everything continued still. A wild hope came to Mr. Ledbetter that the unknown was in a fitter suddenly dead, with his head upon the writing table. The stillness continued. What had happened? The desire to peep became irresistible. Very cautiously Mr. Ledbetter shifted his hand forward, projected a pioneer finger, and began to lift the valance immediately next his eye. Nothing broke the stillness. He saw now the stranger's knees, saw the back of the writing table, and then he was staring at the barrel of a heavy revolver pointed over the writing table at his head. "Come out of that, you scoundrel," said the voice of the stout gentleman in a tone of quiet concentration. "See, come out. This side, and now. None of your hanky-panky, come right out now." Mr. Ledbetter came right out, a little reluctantly perhaps, but without any hanky-panky, and at once, even as he was told. "Kneel," said the stout gentleman. "And hold up your hands." The valance dropped again behind Mr. Ledbetter, and he rose from all fours and held up his hands. "He dressed like a parson," said the stout gentleman. "I'm blessed if he isn't. A little chap too. You scoundrel. What the deuce possessed you to come here tonight? What the deuce possessed you to get under my bed?" He did not appear to require an answer, but proceeded at once to several very objectionable remarks upon Mr. Ledbetter's personal appearance. He was not a very big man, but he looked strong to Mr. Ledbetter. He was as stout as his legs had promised. He had rather delicately chiseled small features distributed over a considerable area of whitish face, and quite a number of chins. And the note of his voice had a sort of whispering undertone. "What the deuce, I say, possessed you to get under my bed?" Mr. Ledbetter, by an effort, smiled a wan propitiatory smile. He coughed. I can quite understand," he said. "Why? What on earth? It's soap. No, you scoundrel. Don't you move that hand. It's soap," said Mr. Ledbetter. "F from your washstand." "No doubt it, don't talk," said the stout man. I see it's soap. Of all incredible things. If I might explain, don't explain. It's sure to be a lie, and there's no time for explanations. What was I going to ask you? Have you any mates? In a few minutes, if you have you any mates? Curse you. If you start any soapy palaver, I'll shoot. Have you any mates? No, said Mr. Ledbetter. I suppose it's a lie, said the stout man. But you'll pay for it if it is. Why the deuce didn't you floor me when I came upstairs? You won't get a chance to now, anyhow. Fancy getting under the bed. I reckon it's a fair cop, anyhow, so far as you are concerned. I don't see how I could prove an alibi, remarked Mr. Ledbetter, trying to show by his conversation that he was an educated man. There was a pause. Mr. Ledbetter perceived that on a chair beside his captor was a large black bag on a heap of crumpled papers, and that there were torn and burnt papers on the table. And in front of these, and arranged methodically along the edge, were rows and rows of little yellow rouleaux 100 times more gold than Mr. Ledbetter had seen in all his life before. The light of 2 candles, and silver candlesticks, fell upon these. The pause continued. It is rather fatiguing holding up my hands like this, said Mr. Ledbetter, with a deprecatory smile. That's all right, said the fat man. But what to do with you, I don't exactly know. I know my position is ambiguous. Lord, said the fat man, ambiguous. And goes about with his own soap, and wears a thundering great clerical collar. You are a blooming burglar, you are, if ever there was one. To be strictly accurate, said Mr. Ledbetter, and suddenly his glasses slipped off, and clattered against his vest buttons. The fat man changed countenance, a flash of savage resolution crossed his face, and something in the revolver clicked. He put his other hand to the weapon. And then he looked at Mr. Ledbetter, and his eye went down to the dropped pince-nez. full cock now, anyhow, said the fat man, after a pause, and his breath seemed to catch. Be but I'll tell you, you've never been so near death before. Lord! I'm almost glad. If it hadn't been that the revolver wasn't cocked, you'd be lying dead there now. Mr. Ledbetter said nothing, but he felt that the room was swaying. A miss is as good as a mile. It's lucky for both of us it wasn't. Lord! He blew noisily. There's no need for you to go pale green for a little thing like that. If I can assure you, sir, said Mr. Ledbetter, with an effort. There's only one thing to do. If I call in the police, I'm bust a little game I've got on this bust. That won't do. If I tie you up, and leave you again, the thing may be out tomorrow. Tomorrow's Sunday, and Monday's bank holiday. I've counted on 3 clear days. Shooting is murder and hanging, and besides, it will bust the whole blooming kernels. I'm hanged if I can think what to do, I'm hanged if I can. Will you permit me, you gas as much as if you were a real parson, I'm blessed if you don't. Of all the burglars you are the well. No. I won't permit you. There isn't time. If you start off jawing again, I'll shoot right in your stomach. See? But I know now. What we're going to do first, my man, is an examination for concealed arms. An examination for concealed arms. And look here. When I tell you to do a thing, don't start off at a gabble, do it brisk. And with many elaborate precautions, and always pointing the pistol at Mr. Ledbetter's head, the stout man stood him up, and searched him for weapons. W.Y., you are a burglar. He said, you're a perfect amateur. You haven't even a pistol pocket in the back of your breeches. No, you don't. Shut up, now. So soon as the issue was decided, the stout man made Mr. Ledbetter take off his coat, and roll up his shirt sleeves, and, with the revolver at one ear, proceed with the packing his appearance had interrupted. From the stout man's point of view, that was evidently the only possible arrangement, for if he had packed, he would have had to put down the revolver. So that even the gold on the table was handled by Mr. Ledbetter. This nocturnal packing was peculiar. The stout man's idea was evidently to distribute the weight of the gold as unostentatiously as possible through his luggage. It was by no means an inconsiderable weight. There was, Mr. Ledbetter says, altogether nearly L18,000 in gold in the black bag, and on the table. There were also many little rolls of L5 banknotes. Each rouleau of L25 was wrapped by Mr. Ledbetter in paper. These rouleaux were then put neatly in cigar boxes, and distributed between a traveling trunk, a Gladstone bag, and a hat box. About L600 went in a tobacco tin in a dressing bag. L10 in gold and a number of L5 notes the stout man pocketed. Occasionally he objurgated Mr. Ledbetter's clumsiness, and urged him to hurry, and several times he appealed to Mr. Ledbetter's watch for information. Mr. Ledbetter strapped the trunk and bag, and returned the stout man the keys. It was then 11:50, and until the stroke of midnight the stout man made him sit on the Gladstone bag, while he sat at a reasonably safe distance on the trunk, and held the revolver handy and waited. He appeared to be now in a less aggressive mood, and having watched Mr. Ledbetter for some time, he offered a few remarks. From your accent I judge you are a man of some education, he said, lighting a cigar. And no, don't begin that explanation of yours. I know it will be long-winded from your face, and I am much too old a liar to be interested in other men's lying. You are, I say, a person of education. You do well to dress as a curate. Even among educated people you might pass as a curate. I am a curate, said Mr. Ledbetter, or, at least, you are trying to be. I know. But you didn't ought to burgle. You are not the man to burgle. You are, if I may say it, the thing will have been pointed out to you before, a coward. Do you know, said Mr. Ledbetter, trying to get a final opening, it was that very question, the stout man waved him into silence. You waste your education in burglary. You should do one of two things. Either you should forge, or you should embezzle. For my own part, I embezzle. Yes, I embezzle. What do you think a man could be doing with all this gold but that? Ah, listen. Midnight, dot dot 10, 11, 12. There is something very impressive to me in that slow beating of the hours. Time, space, what mysteries they are. What mysteries? Dot dot, it's time for us to be moving. Stand up. And then kindly, but firmly, he induced Mr. Ledbetter to sling the dressing bag over his back by a string across his chest, to shoulder the trunk, and, overruling a gasping protest, to take the Gladstone bag in his disengaged hand. So encumbered, Mr. Ledbetter struggled perilously downstairs. The stout gentleman followed with an overcoat, the hatbox, and the revolver, making derogatory remarks about Mr. Ledbetter's strength, and assisting him at the turnings of the stairs. The back door, he directed, and Mr. Ledbetter staggered through a conservatory, leaving a wake of smashed flower pots behind him. Never mind the crockery, said the stout man. It's good for trade. We wait here until a quarter past. You can put those things down. You have. Mr. Ledbetter collapsed panting on the trunk. Last night, he gasped, I was asleep in my little room, and I no more dreamt. There's no need for you to incriminate yourself, said the stout gentleman, looking at the lock of the revolver. He began to hum. Mr. Ledbetter made to speak, and thought better of it. There presently came the sound of a bell, and Mr. Ledbetter was taken to the back door and instructed to open it. A fair-haired man in yachting costume entered. At the sight of Mr. Ledbetter he started violently, and clapped his hand behind him. Then he saw the stout man. B. Bingham! He cried, who's this? Only a little philanthropic do of mine, burglar I'm trying to reform. Caught him under my bed just now. He's all right. He's a frightful ass. He'll be useful to carry some of our things. The newcomer seemed inclined to resent Mr. Ledbetter's presence at first, but the stout man reassured him. He's quite alone. There's not a gang in the world would own him. No. Don't start talking, for goodness' sake. They went out into the darkness of the garden with the trunk still bowing Mr. Ledbetter's shoulders. The man in the yachting costume walked in front with a Gladstone bag and a pistol, then came Mr. Ledbetter like Atlas. Mr. Bingham followed with the hatbox, coat, and revolver as before. The house was one of those that have their gardens right up to the cliff. At the cliff was a steep wooden stairway, descending to a bathing tent dimly visible on the beach. Below was a boat pulled up, and a silent little man with a black face stood beside it. A few moments' explanation, said Mr. Ledbetter. I can assure you somebody kicked him, and he said no more. They made him wade to the boat, carrying the trunk. They pulled him aboard by the shoulders and hair. They called him no better name than Coundrel and Urgler all that night. But they spoke in undertones, so that the general public was happily unaware of his ignominy. They hauled him aboard a yacht manned by strange unsympathetic Orientals, and partly they thrust him, and partly he fell down a gangway into a noisome, dark place, where he was to remain many days, how many he does not know, because he lost count among other things when he was seasick. They fed him on biscuits and incomprehensible words. They gave him water to drink mixed with unwished for rum. And there were cockroaches where they put him. Night and day there were cockroaches, and in the nighttime there were rats. The Orientals emptied his pockets, and took his watch, but Mr. Bingham, being appealed to, took it himself. And five or six times the five Lascars, if they were Lascars, and the Chinaman, and the Negro who constituted the crew, fished him out, and took him after Bingham and his friend, to play cribbage and euchre and three-handed whist, and to listen to their stories and boastings in an interested manner. Then these principals would talk to him as men talk to those who have lived a life of crime. explanations they would never permit, though they made it abundantly clear to him that he was the rummiest burglar they had ever set eyes on. They said as much again and again. The fair man was of a taciturn disposition and irascible at play, but Mr. Bingham, now that the evident anxiety of his departure from England was assuaged, displayed a vein of genial philosophy. He enlarged upon the mystery of space and time, and quoted Kant and Hegel, or, at least, he said he did. Several times Mr. Ledbetter got as far as colon my position under your bed, you know, but then he always had to cut, or pass the whiskey, or do some such intervening thing. After his third failure, the fair man got quiet, to look for this opening, and whenever Mr. Ledbetter began after that, he would roar with laughter, and hit him violently on the back. Same old start, same old story. Good old burglar, the fair-haired man would say. So Mr. Ledbetter suffered for many days, 20 perhaps, and one evening he was taken, together with some tinned provisions, over the side and put ashore on a rocky little island with a spring. Mr. Bingham came in the boat with him, giving him good advice all the way, and waving his last attempts at an explanation aside. I am really not a burglar, said Mr. Ledbetter. You never will be, said Mr. Bingham. Why, you'll never make a burglar. I'm glad you are beginning to see it. In choosing a profession, a man must study his temperament. If you don't, sooner or later you will fail. Compare myself, for example. All my life I have been in banks, I have got on in banks. I have even been a bank manager. But was I happy? No. Why wasn't I happy? Because it did not suit my temperament. I am too adventurous, too versatile. Practically I have thrown it over. I do not suppose I shall ever manage a bank again. They would be glad to get me, no doubt, but I have learned the lesson of my temperament at last. No. I shall never manage a bank again. Now, your temperament unfits you for crime just as mine unfits me for respectability. I know you better than I did, and now I do not even recommend forgery. Go back to respectable courses, my man. Your lay is the philanthropic lay that is your lay. With that voice, the Association for the Promotion of Sniveling Among the Young, something in that line. You think it over. The island we are approaching has no name, apparently, at least, there is none on the chart. You might think out a name for it, while you are there, while you are thinking about all these things. It has quite drinkable water, I understand. It is one of the Grenadines, one of the Windward Islands. Yonder, dim and blue, are others of the Grenadines. There are quantities of Grenadines, but the majority are out of sight. I have often wondered what these islands are for. Now, you see, I am wiser. This one at least is for you. Sooner or later some simple native will come along and take you off. Say what you like about us then, abuse us. If you like, we shan't care a solitary Grenadine. And here is half a sovereign's worth of silver. Do not waste that in foolish dissipation when you return to civilization. Properly used, it may give you a fresh start in life. And don't beach her, you beggars, he can wade. Do not waste the precious solitude before you in foolish thoughts. Properly used, it may be a turning point in your career. Waste neither money nor time. You will die rich. I'm sorry, but I must ask you to carry your tucker, to land in your arms. No, it's not deep. Curse that explanation of yours. There's not time. No. I won't listen. Overboard you go. And the falling night found Mr. Ledbetter, the Mr. Ledbetter who had complained that adventure was dead, sitting beside his cans of food, his chin resting upon his drawn-up knees, staring through his glasses in dismal mildness over the shining, vacant sea. He was picked up in the course of 3 days by a Negro fisherman and taken to St. Vincent's, and from St. Vincent's he got, by the expenditure of his last coins, to Kingston, in Jamaica. And there he might have foundered. Even nowadays he is not a man of affairs, and then he was a singularly helpless person. He had not the remotest idea what he ought to do. The only thing he seems to have done was to visit all the ministers of religion he could find in the place to borrow a passage home. But he was much too dirty and incoherent and his story far too incredible for them. I met him quite by chance. It was close upon sunset, and I was walking out after my siesta on the road to Dunn's Battery. When I met him, I was rather bored, and with a whole evening on my hands, luckily for him. He was trudging dismally towards the town. His weebigan face and the quasi-clerical cut of his dust-stained, filthy costume caught my humor. Our eyes met. He hesitated. "Yes, sir," he said, with a catching of the breath. "Could you spare a few minutes for what I fear will seem an incredible story?" "Incredible," I said. "Quite," he answered eagerly. "And no one will believe it, alter it though I may. Yet I can assure you, sir," he stopped hopelessly. The man's tone tickled me. He seemed an odd character. I am," he said, "one of the most unfortunate beings alive." "Among other things, you haven't dined?" I said, struck with an idea. "I have not," he said solemnly, "for many days." "You'll tell it better after that," I said, and without more ado, led the way to a low place I knew, where such a costume as his was unlikely to give offense. And there, with certain omissions which he subsequently supplied, I got his story. At first I was incredulous. But as the wine warmed him, and the faint suggestion of cringing which his misfortunes had added to his manner disappeared, I began to believe. At last, I was so far convinced of his sincerity, that I got him a bet for the night, and next day verified the banker's reference he gave me through my Jamaica banker. And that done, I took him shopping for underwear, and such like equipments of a gentleman at large. Presently came the verified reference. His astonishing story was true. I will not amplify our subsequent proceedings. He started for England in 3 days' time. "I do not know how I can possibly thank you enough," began the letter he wrote me from England, "for all your kindness to a total stranger," and proceeded for some time in a similar strain. "H. had it not been for your generous assistance, I could certainly never have returned in time for the resumption of my scholastic duties, and my few minutes of reckless folly would, perhaps, have proved my ruin. As it is, I am entangled in a tissue of lies and evasions, of the most complicated sort, to account for my sunburnt appearance and my whereabouts. I have rather carelessly told two or three different stories, not realizing the trouble this would mean for me in the end. The truth I dare not tell. I have consulted a number of law books in the British Museum, and there is not the slightest doubt that I have connived at and abetted and aided a felony. That scoundrel Bingham was the Hithergate bank manager, I find, and guilty of the most flagrant embezzlement. Please, please burn this letter. When read, I trust you implicitly. The worst of it is, neither my aunt nor her friend who kept the boarding house at which I was staying seem altogether to believe a guarded statement I have made them practically of what actually happened. They suspect me of some discreditable adventure, but what sort of discreditable adventure they suspect me of, I do not know. My aunt says she would forgive me if I told her everything. I have told her more than everything, and still she is not satisfied. It would never do to let them know the truth of the case, of course, and so I represent myself as having been waylaid and gagged upon the beach. My aunt wants to know why they waylaid and gagged me, why they took me away in their yacht. I do not know. Can you suggest any reason? I can think of nothing. If, when you wrote, you could write on two sheets, so that I could show her one, and on that one, if you could show clearly that I really was in Jamaica this summer, and had come there by being removed from a ship, it would be of great service to me. It would certainly add to the load of my obligation to you, a load that I fear I can never fully repay. Although if gratitude... dot and so forth. At the end he repeated his request for me to burn the letter. So the remarkable story of Mr. Ledbetter's vacation ends. That breach with his aunt was not of long duration. The old lady had forgiven him before she died. Chapter, The Stolen Body. Mr. Bessel was the senior partner in the firm of Bessel, Hart, and Brown, of St. Paul's Churchyard, and for many years he was well known among those interested in psychical research as a liberal-minded and conscientious investigator. He was an unmarried man, and instead of living in the suburbs, after the fashion of his class, he occupied rooms in the Albany, near Piccadilly. He was particularly interested in the questions of thought transference, and of apparitions of the living, and in November, 1896, he commenced a series of experiments in conjunction with Mr. Vincey, of Staple Inn, in order to test the alleged possibility of projecting an apparition of oneself by force of will through space. Their experiments were conducted in the following manner. At a prearranged hour, Mr. Bessel shut himself in one of his rooms in the Albany and Mr. Vincey in his sitting room in Staple Inn, and each then fixed his mind as resolutely as possible on the other. Mr. Bessel had acquired the art of self-hypnotism, and, so far as he could, he attempted first to hypnotize himself, and then to project himself as a phantom of the living across the intervening space of nearly 2 miles into Mr. Vincey's apartment. On several evenings this was tried without any satisfactory result, but on the fifth or sixth occasion Mr. Vincey did actually see or imagine he saw an apparition of Mr. Bessel standing in his room. He states that the appearance, although brief, was very vivid and real. He noticed that Mr. Bessel's face was white, and his expression anxious, and, moreover, that his hair was disordered. For a moment Mr. Vincey, in spite of his state of expectation, was too surprised to speak or move, and in that moment it seemed to him, as though the figure glanced over its shoulder and incontinently vanished. It had been arranged that an attempt should be made to photograph any phantasm seen, but Mr. Vincey had not the instant presence of mind to snap the camera that lay ready on the table beside him, and when he did, so he was too late. Greatly elated, however, even by this partial success, he made a note of the exact time, and at once took a cab to the Albany to inform Mr. Bessel of this result. He was surprised to find Mr. Bessel's outer door standing open to the night, and the inner apartments lit and in an extraordinary disorder. An empty champagne magnum lay smashed upon the floor, its neck had been broken off against the inkpot on the bureau, and lay beside it. An octagonal occasional table, which carried a bronze statuette and a number of choice books, had been rudely overturned, and down the primrose paper of the wall inky fingers had been drawn, as it seemed for the mere pleasure of defilement. One of the delicate chintz curtains had been violently torn from its rings and thrust upon the fire, so that the smell of its smoldering filled the room. Indeed, the whole place was disarranged in the strangest fashion. For a few minutes Mr. Vincey, who had entered sure of finding Mr. Bessel in his easy chair awaiting him, could scarcely believe his eyes, and stood staring helplessly at these unanticipated things. Then, full of a vague sense of calamity, he sought the porter at the entrance lodge. "Where is Mr. Bessel?" he asked. "Do you know that all the furniture is broken in Mr. Bessel's room?" The porter said nothing, but, obeying his gestures, came at once to Mr. Bessel's apartment, to see the state of affairs. "Tea settles it," he said, surveying the lunatic confusion. I didn't know of this. Mr. Bessel's gone off. He's mad." He then proceeded to tell Mr. Vincey that about half an hour previously, that is to say, at about the time of Mr. Bessel's apparition in Mr. Vincey's rooms, the missing gentleman had rushed out of the gates of the Albany into Vigo Street, hatless and with disordered hair, and had vanished into the direction of Bond Street. "And as he went past me," said the porter, "he laughed a sort of gasping laugh, with his mouth open and his eyes glaring. I tell you, sir, he fair scared me. Like this." According to his imitation, it was anything but a pleasant laugh. He waved his hand, with all his fingers crooked and clawing like that. And he said, in a sort of fierce whisper, "Life! apostrophe just that one word, life. Apostrophe, dear me, said Mr. Vincey. Tee tut, tut, and hear me. He could think of nothing else to say. He was naturally very much surprised. He turned from the room to the porter, and from the porter to the room in the gravest perplexity. Beyond his suggestion, that probably Mr. Bessel would come back presently, and explain what had happened, their conversation was unable to proceed. It might be a sudden toothache, said the porter, a very sudden and violent toothache, jumping on him suddenly like and driving him wild. I've broken things myself before now in such a case. Dotty thought that if it was, why should he say life to me as he went past? Mr. Vincey did not know. Mr. Bessel did not return, and at last Mr. Vincey, having done some more helpless staring, and having addressed a note of brief inquiry, and left it in a conspicuous position on the bureau, returned in a very perplexed frame of mind to his own premises in Staple Inn. This affair had given him a shock. He was at a loss to account for Mr. Bessel's conduct on any sane hypothesis. He tried to read, but he could not do so. He went for a short walk, and was so preoccupied that he narrowly escaped a cab at the top of Chancery Lane, and at last, a full hour before his usual time, he went to bed. For a considerable time he could not sleep, because of his memory of the silent confusion of Mr. Bessel's apartment, and when at length he did attain an uneasy slumber it was at once disturbed by a very vivid and distressing dream of Mr. Bessel. He saw Mr. Bessel gesticulating wildly, and with his face white and contorted, and, inexplicably mingled with his appearance, suggested perhaps by his gestures, was an intense fear, an urgency to act. He even believes that he heard the voice of his fellow experimenter calling distressfully to him, though at the time he considered this to be an illusion. The vivid impression remained, though Mr. Vincey awoke. For a space he lay awake and trembling in the darkness, possessed with that vague, unaccountable terror of unknown possibilities that comes out of dreams upon even the bravest men. But at last he roused himself, and turned over, and went to sleep again, only for the dream to return with enhanced vividness. He awoke with such a strong conviction that Mr. Bessel was in overwhelming distress and need of help that sleep was no longer possible. He was persuaded that his friend had rushed out to some dire calamity. For a time he lay reasoning vainly against this belief, but at last he gave way to it. He arose, against all reason, lit his gas, undressed, and set out through the deserted streets deserted, save for a noiseless policeman or so, and the yearly news carts towards Vigo Street to inquire if Mr. Bessel had returned. But he never got there. As he was going down Long Acre, some unaccountable impulse turned him aside out of that street towards Covent Garden, which was just waking to its nocturnal activities. He saw the market in front of him, a queer effect of glowing yellow lights and busy black figures. He became aware of a shouting, and perceived a figure turn the corner by the hotel and run swiftly towards him. He knew at once that it was Mr. Bessel, but it was Mr. Bessel transfigured. He was hatless and disheveled, his collar was torn open, he grasped a bone-handled walking cane near the ferrule end, and his mouth was pulled awry. And he ran, with agile strides, very rapidly. Their encounter was the affair of an instant. B. Bessel! Cried Vincey. The running man gave no sign of recognition either of Mr. Vincey, or of his own name. Instead, he cut at his friend savagely with a stick, hitting him in the face within an inch of the eye. Mr. Vincey, stunned and astonished, staggered back, lost his footing, and fell heavily on the pavement. It seemed to him that Mr. Bessel leapt over him as he fell. When he looked again, Mr. Bessel had vanished, and a policeman and a number of garden porters and salesmen were rushing past towards Long Acre in hot pursuit. With the assistance of several passers-by, for the whole street was speedily alive with running people, Mr. Vincey struggled to his feet. He at once became the center of a crowd greedy to see his injury. A multitude of voices competed to reassure him of his safety, and then to tell him of the behavior of the madman, as they regarded Mr. Bessel. He had suddenly appeared in the middle of the market screaming, "Life! Life!" striking left and right with a blood-stained walking stick, and dancing and shouting with laughter at each successful blow. A lad and two women had broken heads, and he had smashed a man's wrist. A little child had been knocked insensible, and for a time he had driven everyone before him, so furious and resolute had his behavior been. Then he made a raid upon a coffee stall, hurled its paraffin flare through the window of the post office, and fled laughing, after stunning the foremost of the two policemen who had the pluck to charge him. Mr. Vincey's first impulse was naturally to join in the pursuit of his friend, in order if possible to save him from the violence of the indignant people. But his action was slow, the blow had half stunned him, and while this was still no more than a resolution came the news, shouted through the crowd, that Mr. Bessel had eluded his pursuers. At first Mr. Vincey could scarcely credit this, but the universality of the report, and presently the dignified return of two feudal policemen, convinced him. After some aimless inquiries he returned towards Staple Inn, padding a handkerchief to a now very painful nose. He was angry, and astonished and perplexed. It appeared to him indisputable that Mr. Bessel must have gone violently mad in the midst of his experiment in thought transference, but why that should make him appear with a sad white face in Mr. Vincey's dream seemed a problem beyond solution. He racked his brains in vain to explain this. It seemed to him at last that not simply Mr. Bessel, but the order of things must be insane. But he could think of nothing to do. He shut himself carefully into his room, lit his fire, it was a gas fire with asbestos bricks, and, fearing fresh dreams, if he went to bed, remained bathing his injured face, or holding up books in a vain attempt to read, until dawn. Throughout that vigil he had a curious persuasion that Mr. Bessel was endeavoring to speak to him, but he would not let himself attend to any such belief. About dawn, his physical fatigue asserted itself, and he went to bed, and slept at last in spite of dreaming. He rose late, unrested and anxious, and in considerable facial pain. The morning papers had no news of Mr. Bessel's aberration, it had come too late for them. Mr. Vincey's perplexities, to which the fever of his bruise added fresh irritation, became at last intolerable, and, after a fruitless visit to the Albany, he went down to St. Paul's Churchyard to Mr. Hart, Mr. Bessel's partner, and, so far as Mr. Vincey knew, his nearest friend. He was surprised to learn that Mr. Hart, although he knew nothing of the outbreak, had also been disturbed by a vision, the very vision, that Mr. Vincey had seen Mr. Bessel, white and disheveled, pleading earnestly by his gestures for help. That was his impression of the import of his signs. I was just going to look him up in the Albany when you arrived, said Mr. Hart. I was so sure of something being wrong with him. As the outcome of their consultation the two gentlemen decided to inquire at Scotland Yard for news of their missing friend. He is bound to be laid by the heels, said Mr. Hart. He can't go on at that pace for long. But the police authorities had not laid Mr. Bessel by the heels. They confirmed Mr. Vincey's overnight experiences and added fresh circumstances, some of an even graver character than those he knew, a list of smashed glass along the upper half of Tottenham Court Road, an attack upon a policeman in Hampstead Road, and an atrocious assault upon a woman. All these outrages were committed between 12:30 and 1:45 in the morning, and between those hours and, indeed, from the very moment of Mr. Bessel's first rush from his rooms at 9:30 in the evening they could trace the deepening violence of his fantastic career. For the last hour, at least from before 1, that is, until 1:45, he had run amok through London, eluding with amazing agility every effort to stop or capture him. But after 1:45 he had vanished. Up to that hour witnesses were multitudinous. Dozens of people had seen him, fled from him or pursued him, and then things suddenly came to an end. At 1:45 he had been seen running down the Euston Road towards Baker Street, flourishing a can of burning coal's oil and jerking splashes of flame therefrom at the windows of the houses he passed. But none of the policemen on Euston Road beyond the waxwork exhibition, nor any of those in the side streets down which he must have passed had he left the Euston Road, had seen anything of him. Abruptly he disappeared. Nothing of his subsequent doings came to light in spite of the keenest inquiry. Here was a fresh astonishment for Mr. Vincey. He had found considerable comfort in Mr. Hart's conviction, he is bound to be laid by the heels before long, and in that assurance he had been able to suspend his mental perplexities. But any fresh development seemed destined to add new impossibilities to a pile already heaped beyond the powers of his acceptance. He found himself doubting whether his memory might not have played him some grotesque trick, debating whether any of these things could possibly have happened, and in the afternoon he hunted up Mr. Hart again, to share the intolerable weight on his mind. He found Mr. Hart engaged with a well-known private detective. But as that gentleman accomplished nothing in this case, we need not enlarge upon his proceedings. All that day Mr. Bessel's whereabouts eluded an unceasingly active inquiry, and all that night. And all that day there was a persuasion in the back of Vincey's mind that Mr. Bessel sought his attention, and all through the night Mr. Bessel with a tear-stained face of anguish pursued him through his dreams. And whenever he saw Mr. Bessel in his dreams he also saw a number of other faces, vague but malignant, that seemed to be pursuing Mr. Bessel. It was on the following day, Sunday, that Mr. Vincey recalled certain remarkable stories of Mrs. Bullock, the medium, who was then attracting attention for the first time in London. He determined to consult her. She was staying at the house of that well-known inquirer, Dr. Wilson Paget, and Mr. Vincey, although he had never met that gentleman before, repaired to him forthwith with the intention of invoking her help. But scarcely had he mentioned the name of Bessel, when Dr. Paget interrupted him. "Last night, just at the end," he said, "we had a communication." He left the room, and returned with a slate on which were certain words written in a handwriting, shaky indeed, but indisputably the handwriting of Mr. Bessel. "How did you get this?" said Mr. Vincey. "Do you mean, we got it last night?" said Dr. Paget. With numerous interruptions from Mr. Vincey, he proceeded to explain how the writing had been obtained. "It appears that in her seances, Mrs. Bullock passes into a condition of trance, her eyes rolling up in a strange way under her eyelids, and her body becoming rigid. She then begins to talk very rapidly, usually in voices other than her own. At the same time one or both of her hands may become active, and if slates and pencils are provided they will then write messages simultaneously with, and quite independently of the flow of words from her mouth. By many she is considered an even more remarkable medium than the celebrated Mrs. Piper. It was one of these messages, the one written by her left hand, that Mr. Vincey now had before him. It consisted of 8 words written disconnectedly: George Bessel. Trial excavn. Baker Street. Help. Starvation. Curiously enough, neither Dr. Paget nor the 2 other inquirers who were present had heard of the disappearance of Mr. Bessel. The news of it appeared only in the evening papers of Saturday, and they had put the message aside with many others of a vague and enigmatical sort that Mrs. Bullock has from time to time delivered. When Dr. Paget heard Mr. Vincey's story, he gave himself at once with great energy to the pursuit of this clue to the discovery of Mr. Bessel. It would serve no useful purpose here to describe the inquiries of Mr. Vincey and himself. Suffice it that the clue was a genuine one, and that Mr. Bessel was actually discovered by its aid. He was found at the bottom of a detached shaft which had been sunk, and abandoned at the commencement of the work for the new electric railway near Baker Street Station. His arm and leg and 2 ribs were broken. The shaft is protected by a hoarding nearly 20 feet high, and over this, incredible as it seems, Mr. Bessel, a stout, middle-aged gentleman, must have scrambled in order to fall down the shaft. He was saturated in coal's oil, and the smashed tin lay beside him, but luckily the flame had been extinguished by his fall, and his madness had passed from him altogether. But he was, of course, terribly enfeebled, and at the sight of his rescuers he gave way to hysterical weeping. In view of the deplorable state of his flat, he was taken to the house of Dr. Hatton in Upper Baker Street. Here he was subjected to a sedative treatment, and anything that might recall the violent crisis through which he had passed was carefully avoided. But on the second day he volunteered a statement. Since that occasion Mr. Bessel has several times repeated this statement to myself among other people, varying the details as the narrator of real experiences always does, but never by any chance contradicting himself in any particular. And the statement he makes is in substance as follows. In order to understand it clearly, it is necessary to go back to his experiments with Mr. Vincey before his remarkable attack. Mr. Bessel's first attempts at self-projection, in his experiments with Mr. Vincey, were, as the reader will remember, unsuccessful. But through all of them, he was concentrating all his power and will upon getting out of the body, illing it with all my might, he says. At last, almost against expectation, came success. And Mr. Bessel asserts that he, being alive, did actually, by an effort of will, leave his body and pass into some place or state outside this world. The release was, he asserts, instantaneous. At one moment I was seated in my chair, with my eyes tightly shut, my hands gripping the arms of the chair, doing all I could to concentrate my mind on Vincey, and then I perceived myself outside my body, saw my body near me, but certainly not containing me, with the hands relaxing, and the head drooping forward on the breast. Nothing shakes him in his assurance of that release. He describes in a quiet, matter-of-fact way the new sensation he experienced. He felt he had become impalpable, so much he had expected, but he had not expected to find himself enormously large. So, however, it would seem he became. I was a great cloud, if I may express it that way, anchored to my body. It appeared to me, at first, as if I had discovered a greater self, of which the conscious being in my brain was only a little part. I saw the Albany and Piccadilly and Regent Street, and all the rooms and places in the houses, very minute and very bright and distinct, spread out below me like a little city seen from a balloon. Every now and then vague shapes like drifting wreaths of smoke made the vision a little indistinct, but at first I paid little heed to them. The thing that astonished me most, and which astonishes me still, is that I saw quite distinctly the insides of the houses as well as the streets, saw little people dining and talking in the private houses, men and women dining, playing billiards, and drinking in restaurants and hotels, and several places of entertainment crammed with people. It was like watching the affairs of a glass hive. Such were Mr. Bessel's exact words as I took them down when he told me the story. Quite forgetful of Mr. Vincey, he remained for a space observing these things. Impelled by curiosity, he says, he stooped down, and, with the shadowy arm he found himself possessed of, attempted to touch a man walking along Vigo Street. But he could not do so, though his finger seemed to pass through the man. Something prevented his doing this, but what it was he finds it hard to describe. He compares the obstacle to a sheet of glass. I felt as a kitten may feel, he said, when it goes for the first time to pat its reflection in a mirror. Again and again, on the occasion when I heard him tell his story, Mr. Bessel returned to that comparison of the sheet of glass. Yet it was not altogether a precise comparison, because, as the reader will speedily see, there were interruptions of this generally impermeable resistance, means of getting through the barrier to the material world again. But, naturally, there is a very great difficulty in expressing these unprecedented impressions in the language of everyday experience. A thing that impressed him instantly, and which weighed upon him throughout all his experience, was the stillness of this place. He was in a world without sound. At first Mr. Bessel's mental state was an unemotional wonder. His thought chiefly concerned itself with where he might be. He was out of the body, out of his material body, at any rate, but that was not all. He believes, and I for one believe also, that he was somewhere out of space, as we understand it, altogether. By a strenuous effort of will he had passed out of his body into a world beyond this world, a world undreamt of, yet lying so close to it, and so strangely situated with regard to it that all things on this earth are clearly visible both from without and from within in this other world about us. For a long time, as it seemed to him, this realization occupied his mind to the exclusion of all other matters, and then he recalled the engagement with Mr. Vincey, to which this astonishing experience was, after all, but a prelude. He turned his mind to locomotion in this new body in which he found himself. For a time he was unable to shift himself from his attachment to his earthly carcass. For a time this new strange cloud body of his simply swayed, contracted, expanded, coiled, and writhed with his efforts to free himself, and then quite suddenly the link that bound him snapped. For a moment everything was hidden by what appeared to be whirling spheres of dark vapor, and then through a momentary gap he saw his drooping body collapse limply, saw his lifeless head drop sideways, and found he was driving along like a huge cloud in a strange place of shadowy clouds that had the luminous intricacy of London spread like a model below. But now he was aware that the fluctuating vapor about him was something more than vapor, and the temerarious excitement of his first essay was shot with fear. For he perceived, at first indistinctly, and then suddenly very clearly, that he was surrounded by faces. That each roll and coil of the seeming cloud stuff was a face. And such faces. Faces of thin shadow, faces of gaseous tenuity. Faces like those faces that glare with intolerable strangeness upon the sleeper in the evil hours of his dreams. Evil, greedy eyes that were full of a covetous curiosity, faces with knit brows and snarling, smiling lips, their vague hands clutched at Mr. Bessel as he passed, and the rest of their bodies was but an elusive streak of trailing darkness. Never a word they said, never a sound from the mouths that seemed to gibber. All about him, they pressed in that dreamy silence, passing freely through the dim mistiness that was his body, gathering ever more numerously about him. And the shadowy Mr. Bessel, now suddenly fear-stricken, drove through the silent active multitude of eyes and clutching hands. So inhuman were these faces, so malignant their staring eyes, and shadowy, clawing gestures, that it did not occur to Mr. Bessel to attempt intercourse with these drifting creatures. Idiot phantoms, they seemed, children of vain desire, beings unborn and forbidden the boon of being, whose only expressions and gestures told of the envy and craving for life that was their one link with existence. It's as much for his resolution that, amidst the swarming cloud of these noiseless spirits of evil, he could still think of Mr. Vincey. He made a violent effort of will and found himself, he knew not how, stooping towards Staple Inn, saw Vincey sitting attentive and alert in his armchair by the fire. And clustering also about him, as they clustered ever about all that lives and breathes, was another multitude of these vain voiceless shadows, longing, desiring, seeking some loophole into life. For a space Mr. Bessel sought ineffectually to attract his friend's attention. He tried to get in front of his eyes, to move the objects in his room, to touch him. But Mr. Vincey remained unaffected, ignorant of the being that was so close to his own. The strange something that Mr. Bessel has compared to a sheet of glass separated them impermeably. And at last Mr. Bessel did a desperate thing. I have told how that in some strange way he could see, not only the outside of a man as we see him, but within. He extended his shadowy hand and thrust his vague black fingers, as it seemed, through the heedless brain. Then, suddenly, Mr. Vincey started like a man who recalls his attention from wandering thoughts, and it seemed to Mr. Bessel that a little dark red body situated in the middle of Mr. Vincey's brain swelled and glowed as he did so. Since that experience, he has been shown anatomical figures of the brain, and he knows now that this is that useless structure, as doctors call it, the pineali. For, strange as it will seem to many, we have, deep in our brains where it cannot possibly see any earthly light an eye. At the time this, with the rest of the internal anatomy of the brain, was quite new to him. At the sight of its changed appearance, however, he thrust forth his finger, and, rather fearful still of the consequences, touched this little spot. And instantly Mr. Vincey started, and Mr. Bessel knew that he was seen. And at that instant it came to Mr. Bessel that evil had happened to his body, and behold, a great wind blew through all that world of shadows, and tore him away. So strong was this persuasion, that he thought no more of Mr. Vincey, but turned about forthwith, and all the countless faces drove back with him like leaves before a gale. But he returned too late. In an instant he saw the body that he had left inert and collapsed, lying, indeed, like the body of a man just dead, had arisen by virtue of some strength and will beyond his own. It stood with staring eyes, stretching its limbs in dubious fashion. For a moment he watched it in wild dismay, and then he stooped towards it. But the pane of glass had closed against him again, and he was foiled. He beat himself passionately against this, and all about him the spirits of evil grinned and pointed and mocked. He gave way to furious anger. He compares himself to a bird that has fluttered heedlessly into a room, and is beating at the window pane that holds it back from freedom. And behold, the little body that had once been his was now dancing with delight. He saw it shouting, though he could not hear its shouts. He saw the violence of its movements grow. He watched it fling his cherished furniture about in the mad delight of existence, rend his books apart, smash bottles, drink heedlessly from the jagged fragments, leap and smite in a passionate acceptance of living. He watched these actions in paralyzed astonishment. Then once more he hurled himself against the impassable barrier, and then with all that crew of mocking ghosts about him, hurried back in dire confusion to Vincey, to tell him of the outrage that had come upon him. But the brain of Vincey was now closed against apparitions, and the disembodied Mr. Bessel pursued him in vain as he hurried out into Holborn to call a cab. Foiled and terror-stricken, Mr. Bessel swept back again, to find his desecrated body whooping in a glorious frenzy down the Burlington Arcade. And now the attentive reader begins to understand Mr. Bessel's interpretation of the first part of this strange story. The being whose frantic rush through London had inflicted so much injury and disaster had indeed Mr. Bessel's body, but it was not Mr. Bessel. It was an evil spirit out of that strange world beyond existence, into which Mr. Bessel had so rashly ventured. For 20 hours it held possession of him, and for all those 20 hours the dispossessed spirit body of Mr. Bessel was going to and fro in that unheard of middle world of shadows seeking help in vain. He spent many hours beating at the minds of Mr. Vincey and of his friend Mr. Hart. Each, as we know, he roused by his efforts. But the language that might convey his situation to these helpers across the gulf he did not know. His feeble fingers groped vainly and powerlessly in their brains. Once, indeed, as we have already told, he was able to turn Mr. Vincey aside from his path, so that he encountered the stolen body in its career, but he could not make him understand the thing that had happened. He was unable to draw any help from that encounter. All through those hours the persuasion was overwhelming in Mr. Bessel's mind that presently his body would be killed by its furious tenant, and he would have to remain in this shadow land forevermore. So that those long hours were a growing agony of fear. and ever as he hurried to and fro in his ineffectual excitement, innumerable spirits of that world about him mobbed him, and confused his mind. And ever an envious applauding multitude poured after their successful fellow as he went upon his glorious career. For that, it would seem, must be the life of these bodiless things of this world, that is the shadow of our world. Ever they watch, coveting a way into a mortal body, in order that they may descend, as furies and frenzies, as violent lusts and mad, strange impulses, rejoicing in the body they have won. For Mr. Bessel was not the only human soul in that place. Witness the fact, that he met first one, and afterwards several shadows of men like himself, it seemed, who had lost their bodies even it may be as he had lost his, and wandered, despairingly, in that lost world, that is neither life nor death. They could not speak, because that world is silent, yet he knew them for men, because of their dim human bodies, and because of the sadness of their faces. But how they had come into that world he could not tell, nor where the bodies they had lost might be, whether they still raved about the earth, or whether they were closed forever in death against return. That they were the spirits of the dead neither he nor I believe. But Dr. Wilson Paget thinks they are the rational souls of men who are lost in madness on the earth. At last Mr. Bessel chanced upon a place, where a little crowd of such disembodied silent creatures was gathered, and thrusting through them, he saw below a brightly lit room, and four or five quiet gentlemen and a woman, a stoutish woman dressed in black bombazin and sitting awkwardly in a chair with her head thrown back. He knew her from her portraits to be Mrs. Bullock, the medium. And he perceived that tracks and structures in her brain glowed and stirred as he had seen the pinnuli in the brain of Mr. Vincey glow. The light was very fitful. Sometimes it was a broad illumination, and sometimes merely a faint twilight spot, and it shifted slowly about her brain. She kept on talking and writing with one hand. And Mr. Bessel saw that the crowding shadows of men about him, and a great multitude of the shadow spirits of that shadowland, were all striving and thrusting to touch the lighted regions of her brain. As one gained her brain or another was thrust away, her voice and the writing of her hand changed, so that what she said was disorderly and confused for the most part. Now a fragment of one soul's message, and now a fragment of another's, and now she babbled the insane fancies of the spirits of vain desire. Then Mr. Bessel understood that she spoke for the spirit that had touch of her, and he began to struggle very furiously towards her. But he was on the outside of the crowd, and at that time he could not reach her, and at last, growing anxious, he went away to find what had happened meanwhile to his body. For a long time he went to and fro seeking it in vain and fearing that it must have been killed, and then he found it at the bottom of the shaft in Baker Street, writhing furiously and cursing with pain. Its leg and an arm and two ribs had been broken by its fall. Moreover, the evil spirit was angry, because his time had been so short, and because of the pain-making violent movements and casting his body about. And at that Mr. Bessel returned with redoubled earnestness to the room, where the seance was going on, and so soon as he had thrust himself within sight of the place he saw one of the men who stood about the medium looking at his watch, as if he meant that the seance should presently end. At that a great number of the shadows who had been striving turned away with gestures of despair. But the thought that the seance was almost over only made Mr. Bessel the more earnest, and he struggled so stoutly with his will against the others, that presently he gained the woman's brain. It chanced that just at that moment it glowed very brightly, and in that instant she wrote the message that Dr. Wilson Paget preserved. And then the other shadows and the cloud of evil spirits about him had thrust Mr. Bessel away from her, and for all the rest of the seance he could regain her no more. So he went back and watched through the long hours at the bottom of the shaft, where the evil spirit lay in the stolen body it had maimed, writhing and cursing, and weeping and groaning, and learning the lesson of pain. and towards dawn the thing he had waited for happened. The brain glowed brightly, and the evil spirit came out, and Mr. Bessel entered the body he had feared he should never enter again. As he did so, the silence, the brooding silence, ended. He heard the tumult of traffic, and the voices of people overhead, and that strange world, that is the shadow of our world, the dark and silent shadows of ineffectual desire, and the shadows of lost men vanished clean away. He lay there for the space of about 3 hours, before he was found. And in spite of the pain and suffering of his wounds, and of the dim damp place in which he lay, in spite of the tears wrung from him by his physical distress, his heart was full of gladness, to know that he was nevertheless back once more in the kindly world of men. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.